Take your seats.
Guy sounds like he's from New Jersey.
Time to get this show on the road.
I wonder. Yeah. Who? The one who never lost the accent.
Uh-oh. Yeah, we'll be okay. Watchmen Live. My name's Randy Noggins. I will be your host for what will prove to be a very informative evening. A lot of content on the show. And the topic that we're going to cover tonight deals with a subject that comes loaded with all sorts of denial and misinformation. But things have to be said, and so Vatican Exposure is the name of this program, and I believe that the gentlemen I have with me for this program tonight are eminently qualified to speak to this. They've all done considerable research. They have significant depth, and I'm going to say this up front. This is not about religion. It is not about Catholic bashing, and I believe that all of my co-hosts will agree with me about this. What you're going to hear tonight deals with the Vatican, the Jesuits, and the intrigues that have taken place throughout history. And we're also going to have some special guests coming in via pre-records as well. So I guess to introduce the matter, my guests with me are from Florida, Keith Hansen, also known as Visigoth, and from the West Coast, Gordon Comstock, and from down in Austin, Texas, Larry the Contractor Guy is with us. Good evening, gentlemen. Welcome.
Hello.
Keith, you want to go ahead and just kind of lead us into this thing?
Yeah, and the reason I am, and I'm not really sure with Larry's entry into this. In fact, I forgot really to ask him how he came about it. But I know that Gordon had come to this kind of after I did. When I first heard the information, I thought it was probably the craziest thing I ever heard. I thought it was ludicrous. But there was a lot of information there that was there for inspection and research. And so I figured, okay, is this the truth? I don't know. I have no axe to grind with anything or anybody or any racial, ethnic group. I just wanted to know the truth, and I found it out. And it's going to be very unsatisfactory to a lot of people. It may not be sexy enough for some, or it may seem delusional to others. But anybody who did the research to find out whether this is real or not came back and said it's real. We all know we've been in the Matrix. We all know that we've been the victims of managed news and history, as it's written in texts and mass consumption books. Well, this is another one of those. And in fact, you can read about the expunging of the footprints of the perps of which we speak tonight. And who was involved with that was the good old Rockefellers. So, where are we at? We're looking at the Vatican and the Society of Jesus. Yeah, I know, unlikely duos who have been involved in trying to gain and seize control over the governments of the world. And they have. They've covered their footprints. And again, this is not an anti-Catholic thing. It is not a pro-Zionist thing. I'm not discounting Zionism whatsoever, as you guys read in a letter I sent to an individual who was whacking Eric John Phelps, which he deserves to a certain extent. But at any rate, it's got nothing to do with that. It's just got to do with who's running the show. And that's what we've come down to. And again, if you do the research, you're going to find it out. If you don't want to do it, that's fine too. But you don't get, I'm not going to listen to you if you tell me that it's all bourgeois, and you don't go ahead and do due diligence. So that's where I'm going to take it right there. I can continue about how I went down a rabbit hole, but for now, I just want to state that. And Gordon, I'm going to throw it to you if you want to tell them, you know, how you came about this.
I came about this. I had heard Eric John Phelps on several shows, and then I heard him on yours, and I thought he was nuts. And then I heard Chuck Wilcox on your show, Viz, and I thought he was nuts. And I by this time had established the fact for myself that you were one of the very few trustworthy guys I could listen to anymore. So I sent you an email, and I just kind of, you know, man to man said, you know, hey, you know, this Wilcox guy and Phelps, these guys are nuts, right? I mean, really? And your response took me back a bit. You said something like, I know, bro, I've been there, but just check it out for yourself. And so I said, okay, I'll check it out for myself. And I bought Charles Wilcox's book, and I read it, and I wished I had a jaw, or I wished I had a pillow underneath me to catch my jaw from hitting the floor. Because not only did Wilcox establish beyond doubt that the Jesuits assassinated Abe Lincoln, but also that they took a shot at assassinating the president before him, Buchanan, and the other presidents in the 1800s who we think died of pneumonia and whatnot. It's a very reasonable conjecture that they were poisoned by the Society of Jesus. What the Wilcox book did also was it opened the door to all of these other resources, all of these other books that were written in the 1800s and early 1900s and are very hard to find now. You can still get them, but they're suppressed. They're not pushed by big publishing houses. And when you check out these other books, which I have, a lot of them, you just find out the overwhelming power that this institution has. And I told Randy, I don't want to call it a vision, I don't know what it was, but after I digested a large number of this information, I just had a thought one day that it felt like a vision, it looked like a vision, but I don't know what it was. For a long time, ever since I was a boy and my dad would tell me about the Illuminati, that's as far as my dad got, I always wondered, who are these people? And, well, whoever they are, I always wondered, you know, who's the real power? And the thought I had one day was, for a long time, I had been stumbling in a dark forest. I kept stumbling, and I couldn't, it was nighttime. I couldn't see very well. I was in a forest, and I kept stumbling. And then I realized, I strained to look down, and at my feet, what I kept stumbling over were tree roots. And then I kept walking and stumbling, though. And then at a certain point, there was a slight break between the trees up above, and I could see up above, it wasn't night, it was daytime, but the trees were making it seem like nighttime. And I realized then, in straining to look around, that the trees, it was all one system, all the root systems were all one, all of the trees were one entity. And that's how I felt after coming across all this information about the Vatican and the Jesuits. And it's really like taking the blue pill, unlike any other New World Order blue pill you could take.
Randy, Larry, do you want to jump in there too about how you came about this?
Well, it was just over a course of a long period of time. I grew up in a non-Catholic Christian family, an evangelical Christian. My grandfather was a missionary Baptist preacher, and he, when I was a boy, would try to give me certain information about the Roman Catholic Church, which he considered to be a counterfeit of true Christianity. And he went on to a long explanation of that. When I was about 11 years old, he gave me a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs, which tells of the history of the Roman Catholic Church and its persecution of the early reformers, the early Protestant reformers. That kind of piqued my curiosity, and over a period of time, I in college became very interested in period of time in Germany in the transition between the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich, and I did a lot of research on that, and I began to realize that the Roman Catholic Church had a lot to do with the rise of the Third Reich, and even before that, they had a lot to do with the rise of Mussolini and the Fascist Party in Italy. And as a result of that, I started delving into it a little more, and especially recently started studying the history of the Jesuits, and began to realize that this is a very powerful, influential, sinister force in the world, and has not really seen the light of day and a great deal of exposure, and you're not going to hear about it in mainstream media. One thing I learned as I was doing research was that one of the biggest investigative journalists of the 20th century was a man named George Seldes. Seldes wrote several books on the Catholic Church, and he was very instrumental in trying to expose the works of the Catholic Church in the Spanish Civil War. And from all those different influences, I began to take quite an interest in the Vatican and in the Jesuits. And I'd like to add, just like Randy said, this is not about Catholic bashing. This is not about wanting to degrade anybody who is a Roman Catholic. Somebody sits on a pew on Sunday, I don't consider them to be any kind of a threat to me or anyone else. Most of them, I'm sure, are just normal, decent folks trying to serve God as they see it. But there are some definite problems within the philosophy and the actions of the Vatican and the Jesuits.
One of the things I think we have to let the listeners know about, and that is the Vatican has been involved in political intrigues since 1100. They now have a seat on the United Nations. They are a nation state, which seems to be forgotten or never known. They have a duality. There's a political side to them, and there's a religious side to them. But they are a nation state. They're richest in the world, and that's something that shouldn't be overlooked. With regard to the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus, started by Ignatius Loyola, probably in late 16th century, if I got that right, they've been at it for 500 years. And they do make a habit out of erasing their footprints. But there are works, and plenty of them, and it's not that just it's somebody's opinion. We have, right now, about 52 works in a bibliography that we've collated, with some more that are coming. The one thing I liked about Wilcox's book, and it's inarguable, is that he put in the book images of newspapers of the time that spoke to the perfidy of the Jesuits and the Romanist influence in the United States. I mean, it's there. There's nothing you can say about it.
National newspapers.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things he sent along to me, and I believe it's in his book as well, I'm getting the second edition as we speak, or the latest edition, and that is a bull from Pope Leo XIII to the Romish world that appeared in a publication in the United States titled The Patriotic American. So this is an encyclical from Leo XIII. And some of the language used in this is very eye-opening. I'm not going to go into it right now. Perhaps after we have Charles's interview aired, I'll do it. But when you see what he had to say to the peoples of the world, this is not idle boasts. And not only that, but prior to him as well, Pius IX in Encyclical 26 stated the Romish Church has an innate right to acquire, hold, and use property without limit. And also basically said that the Vicar of Christ, which is what the Pope is, owns the world. That may seem like it's fatuous, but that's what the measure is. I don't want to jump around too much, But there's something I'd like to read, if you'll allow me at this time. It's short. But this, I think, captures exactly what we're talking about, how you could have these two entities be so powerful, so impacting, and yet be so little known about. This is from John F. Kennedy, April 27, 1961, in the speech he gave before the American Newspaper Publishers Association in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. This is April 27th. This was 10 days after the Bay of Pigs was foiled. And then in September of 1961, Alan Dulles from the CIA was forced to resign by Kennedy for what he considered a sabotage of the Bay of Pigs. So Kennedy knew that his efforts to overthrow the Castro regime had been scuttled deliberately. And he went beyond naming nations, because if he felt it was a Cold War thing, he would have said Russia. Or at that time, well, who else would there have been? Cuba? North Korea? But at any rate, here's what he had to say, and this must have been taken as a very enigmatic statement by Kennedy. But to me, this sums up exactly what you're dealing with the Vatican and with the Society of Jesus. And the fact that their name is Society of Jesus shouldn't mean anything. They could have called them the Beatles. It wouldn't have mattered. They hide behind the name. What a smart thing to do, and it works so well. All right, Kennedy stated, "For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced and praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. It conducts the Cold War, in short, with a wartime discipline no democracy would ever hope or wish to match." And if you want to go back into a major daily newspaper that might be on microfilm in your library, go ahead and take a look, because it's there, and I've seen it myself. This is not, you know, some urban legend, as that supposed speech he made in November in New York prior to his assassination. That's urban legend. This one isn't. So I'll throw it over to you guys as to what you might want to speak to next.
I can build on that. We see old black and white footage of late in the early 60s of in Vietnam, of the Buddhist monks who would self-immolate themselves in public as a protest. And we look at that aghast as Americans nowadays, when we are even shown that, which is seldom. But I remember looking at that when I was younger, saying, what was that all about? And nobody ever told us. What was that all about? Something must have been going on that was just hellacious for somebody to do that. And it was more than one. It was like a dozen of them did that. Well, what was going on at the time was the Catholic dictator at the time, but through him, the Vatican was involved in yet another pogrom. Only this wasn't an anti-Jew pogrom. This was, they were trying to exterminate, or severely oppress, at least, the Buddhists at the time. Even though the Buddhists were like 95% of the country, still they had a Catholic dictator. So that's what they were protesting. Now, that became such an embarrassment globally, a moral and political embarrassment for the U.S., who was supporting BM, the dictator, that, okay, now let's take it over to JFK. We're told, you know, all of these quote-unquote conspiracy theories that people throw around of who assassinated JFK. They talk about the Cubans and the Mafia and the CIA, the one that nobody ever talks about, but you read Avril Manhattan's book called Vietnam, Why Did We Go? He points out the fact that JFK, because of this embarrassment that was going on with Diem, the Catholic dictator over there, JFK tacitly signed off on the assassination of Diem, which, and you know, a president, that's as much as they can ever do on something like that, is tacitly sign off, but apparently he did, and Diem's bodyguards were withdrawn deliberately, and then he was assassinated, and it was less than 3 weeks later, it was 20 days later after JFK did that, that he was assassinated. So he was a disobedient Catholic, and the Vatican had at least was instrumental in his assassination.
Yeah, I don't think at this time we should go into some of their intrigues in Europe especially, but what I'm going to ask you to do, Randy, if you would, is cue up the audio of Bill Hughes, who has written two books, The Secret Terrorists and The Enemy Unmasked. And Bill couldn't be with us tonight, but we did a 20-minute interview, which he speaks about the books that he wrote, how he came to understand what was going on. Randy, at that time, let me ask you, are you okay? Are you queued up with that?
Yeah, we're fine. Anytime you want a roller.
All right, let's do that, and when we come back, too, if you wouldn't mind, Gordon, we can speak, and you and Larry can speak, to some of the perfidy that they have committed in Europe. And let me just add one thing, and we'll go to the audio and then to you guys. And that is, as Charles is pointing out, and as I found out, too, from being involved with international students at the university at which I once worked, and that is Europeans and Canadians are very well aware of what the Vatican and the Jesuits have pulled off. I'll give you one example real quickly as an aside. Kevin Annette, who I've had on twice in an interview, who works with Native peoples in Canada and also got involved with a situation in Quebec, and that's another whole story for another time, but suffice to say that I said to him, I said, well, I'm no fan of the Jesuits. And he said to me, he goes, well, neither am I. He said, you know, he wiped out all of my descendants in the massacre of the Huguenots. So there you go. I mean, this is not even a stretch. And I've even had students tell me that, you know, through their history, like say in Romania, it's been a battle to throw them out, and they come back in, they throw them back out, and they come back in. So the only place where this is a big laugh is in the United States, and you have to wonder why that is. All right, enough of me, and if you don't mind, we'll go to this audio with Bill Hughes.
Bill, I have to ask you, I mean, you've written two books. You could have written about anything, but you wrote about the Vatican Jesuit influence, most specifically in the United States. This usually draws the ire of everybody as some kind of like crazy thing, which we know it's not, but yet people do not want to do the research for whatever reason, and I won't posit one. But let me ask you, when I first heard about this, I thought it was wacky, but I did the research because I wanted to know, and of course I found out the truth. I never asked you when we interviewed those years ago how you came upon this subject. Can you tell us how that all worked out?
Well, I was doing research in 2001. I was doing research. Actually, I've been doing it for many years, but in 2001, I started a little mini-series in my church where I was having an afternoon meeting talking about the role of the Jesuit order and the Catholic Church in history and in current events. And the one reoccurring theme that hit over and over and over again is that the Catholic Church hates liberty. They hate civil liberty. They hate religious liberty. And both of those are fruits of the Protestant Reformation. And so as I was sharing these messages in my church, I realized that the Jesuit order was raised up right after the beginnings of the Protestant Reformation, and that the Jesuit order was raised up for two purposes. Number one was to destroy everything that Protestantism stood for in the world, and two, to reestablish papal supremacy in the earth. Well, then I started applying that to America, and I said, well, wait a minute. America is a Protestant nation. We are based on the principles of the Bill of Rights embodied in the Constitution, and those principles are Protestant. Those are Protestant principles. Freedom of religion, the right to bear arms, the right to face one's accuser, and on and on and on and on. And I looked at that and I said, well, is it possible that the Jesuit order would seek to bring down the United States because we are a Protestant country based on Protestant principles? Is it possible the Jesuit order would seek to attack America? Well, the obvious, the Jesuit order, they either destroy Protestantism or they cease to be Jesuits. Well, you know, I looked at various events that took place in American history, and then I came up to September 11th, and when I saw what happened September 11, 2001, I sat back and I said, all during that day, I said, if this was something that was a plan of the Catholic Church and the Jesuit order, then somehow this terror attack is going to be connected with the destruction of our constitutional liberties. We heard that after Oklahoma City. Well, September 11th, 2001, George Stephanopoulos looked straight into the eyes of Peter Jennings and the millions of viewers on ABC News, and he said, you know, the only way America can avoid this happening again is if we give up our liberties. And I said, bingo! That's exactly what September 11th was all about. It was about the dissecting and decimating of our civil and religious liberties. And George Stephanopoulos, CFR member that he is, made it very, very clear. That was the whole purpose of September 11, 2001. So, you know, for anybody to look at the history of the Jesuit order and the Catholic Church and to say, well, they would have nothing to do with American history or with history today, they have their heads in the sand, because that's the very purpose of the Jesuit order, is to destroy civil and religious liberty. And America is based on those two great principles.
But how did you ever come upon the real deal with the Vatican and the Jesuit provocateurings? With the Vatican, I mean, let's face it, it's a political entity. When I address the Vatican, it's as the nation state it now is, which I think people are reluctant to either remember or understand. So we look at the Vatican as a political entity. And the Jesuits, of course, everybody thinks they're a spiritual order. They are, in fact, a military order. But how did you come upon that information way back when? When was the first awakening for you?
The first awakening was, very frankly, when I was introduced to Bible prophecy. And when I recognized that the Roman Catholic Church was couched in symbolic terms in the books of Daniel and Revelation. In Daniel 7, it talks about a little horn power that claimed to be God, claimed it could forgive sins. In Revelation 13, it talks about a beast that comes out of the sea who commits blasphemy, and that's claiming to be God and claiming to forgive sins. And then you come to Revelation 17, and you see this whore woman that's controlling the political leaders of the world, the bankers of the world, the churches of the world. And all of those symbols identify, without doubt, the Roman Catholic Church system. And so, knowing what the Bible taught, Keith, I went back and I said, I'm going to find books that support the biblical perspective on history and the role, the predominating role of the Catholic Church and the Jesuit order in history. And I was introduced to books like Avril Manhattan's mm-hmm. books, J.E.C. Shepherd's book on the Babington Plot, of course another awesome book called The Great Controversy, written by Ellen White. It's a dynamic expose of history from the destruction of Jerusalem to the end of time that shows clearly the involvement of the Catholic Church throughout history. And then, of course, you know, John Cornwall's book called Hitler's Pope, the books by Edmund Perret, the magazines by Alberto Rivera, the books by Charles Chiniquy. You know, you can go on and on and on. But all of these books support and show very, very clearly the Catholic Church and the Jesuit order's involvement in politics, in banking, and in religion throughout the centuries. And I just put it all together, Keith, in the light of Oklahoma City, September 11, 2001, in the World Trade Center, and said, you know, we're seeing the papacy and the Jesuits' footprints right here on U.S. soil.
What we're doing also, for anyone who wants any more information, we've compiled a bibliography of almost 50 books and some other video sources that are available on websites for those who want to go ahead and avail themselves of the research that's there. And they could decide they want to debunk, you know, all the books across. Actually, some of them, Bill, go back to 1845, 1850, and come from priests who outed themselves from the Vatican. So, I mean, I don't know how people can get around this, but I will say this, and I'm going to ask you to comment. Charles Wilcox, whom you might be familiar with, wrote a book called Transformation of the Republic. Now, he's a Canadian, but he had always told me, he said, you know, you folks down in the States have been shielded from this information, and it's like this veil pulled down about the Romanist influence in America, and he was good enough in his books to unearth some of that. Even to the point where he got his hands on a U.S. publication called The Patriot American, in which they published a bull from Pope Leo XIII, probably around December 1892, and what he had to say about Protestants or heretics, which mean anybody who's not in the Catholic faith, had better convert or else suffer certain calamities and ultimately death. Do you find that the footprints of the Vatican and Jesuit influence in the United States have been pretty much brushed over by almost everybody, to include history books and also any kind of mass consumption history books? They never address this. What's your feeling on that?
There is no question, Keith, that there's been a definite attempt to completely obliterate from people's minds through the Rockefeller Foundation. And, of course, the Rockefellers are
yes.
connected financially to the Jesuit order and the Rothschilds. But they've rewritten history, and this history has been kept away from Americans, especially in the last 110-plus years. You know, in the 1800s, Americans were warned. Samuel B. Morse, the great inventor of the Morse code, he wrote two books. One was published in 1835 called Imminent Dangers to the Free Institutions of the United States through Foreign Immigration. He published another one in 1844 on Foreign Conspiracy Against the United States. Mm-hmm. In both of Morse's books, he pinpoints the Congress at Vienna and the preeminent role of the Jesuit order via the charge of Pius VII to destroy the American Republic. And so Morse warned Americans. Charles Chiniquy warned America. Thomas Harris warned America when he wrote his book on Rome's responsibility for the assassination of Lincoln. Richard Thompson in the 1890s, American Secretary of the Navy, wrote The Footprints of the Jesuits. So, and there were a host of other books written during the 19th century. But you come into the 20th century, Keith, and you know, up until maybe the last 10 or so years, there's been very few books, and for the most part, they have been kept away from the American public because the focal point has been rewriting the history books and banishing the idea of the Catholic Church's involvement. I remember when I was student teaching back in the mid-80s, I was teaching a history class, and the history book I was teaching to the children in this public school completely left out why the pilgrims came to the United States, why they came over here to North America. It said nothing about religious persecution, and So it's been completely removed from the books. And but if somebody will do the research and connect the dots, put the pieces of the puzzle together, you'll see very, very clearly the role of the Vatican and the Jesuits in current history.
Gordon Comstock, whom you're familiar with, and I have exchanged books and such, but one of the things that we both marveled at is that there are books that we have read just, say, happenstance, and there are references to the Jesuits, books that I've already gone through in times and never really paid attention to it because I looked upon the Jesuits as some kind of like, well, you know, they're like some kind of monk order, who cares about them? And now, of course, when we review this, we see that, you know, they're everywhere in a sense, and yet they have this Teflon covering, which doesn't allow anything to sort of stick to them. But let me ask you this. One of the best disguises anyone or anything can have is to be thought of as being incapable of a certain perfidy. With the case of the Vatican and the Jesuits, if you mention that in public, you'll get laughed at immediately, which I find interesting. But let me ask you, have you gone through a great bit of, shall we say, calumny and castigation because of you dealing with that subject matter that you have in your two books, The Secret Terrorist and The Enemy Unmasked?
Absolutely, Keith. It's come in many, many different forms. People making threats, people sending me my book, you know, because we have mass mailed my books to many towns. We did Orlando, Florida, and a host of other places. And I've had people send the books back shredded with a warning sticky note on it saying, "You're next." I've had all kinds of things happen, Keith, from threatening letters to threatening phone calls, people laughing at me, people writing things on the internet to, you know, to make me out to be just an utter nut. Carl Keating, probably one of the main American apologists for the Catholic Church, has something on the internet as far as my book, The Secret Terrorist, is concerned. So it's come in many different forms, Keith. But amazingly enough, Keith, the bottom line is that when people resort to name-calling or threats, it's because they have not done their homework. Anybody, Keith, who will honestly sit down and look at the information, look at the evidence, they can arrive at no other conclusion. And, you know, for the people, Keith, out there that say, well, it's the Jews or the international bankers or, you know, the Illuminati or the CFR or communism or the Bilderbergers or Bohemian Grove, Keith, all they're doing is they're giving us a smokescreen, and they have not done their homework. It's just that simple.
Well, I find it a condition of what we have come to call it intellectual deceit, that when you don't want to go down a road because you don't want to find where it leads, you just do the least that you can possibly do and turn around and say, well, this is all hoodoo and you're all nuts. And that is so very obvious, even as I speak to you this day with an email that I got. And yet, even when, and I'll just give you an example, when Gordon and I were going back and forth and Gordon came across, I forget what worked, he thought it was crazy, just as I thought it was crazy when I first encountered this information. But because there was a certain amount of information involved, which seemed very replete, I said, okay, let me take a look. I mean, I had no dog in this hunt. I didn't care. I mean, I had no access to ground with anyone. I just want to know the way things really work. And when I went down that road, and Gordon did the same thing after first, repulsing at such a thing, we all found out. But the ones who say this is all baloney never, ever want to do the research. And that's not fair. If you want to pan it, do the research.
That's that's the only fair. It's the only fair thing, Keith. I'm convinced that people that resort to name calling and passing it off as that's just a bunch of garbage, Keith, they have an agenda.
Of course.
And it's just that simple. There's an agenda. They're a plant. You know, I believe, Keith, that some of these people like Tex Mars or Alex Jones or Stanley Monteith or some of these other people that I believe they're plants, Keith. I just do, because Rome knew that enough people would start doing research because they would realize they were being lied to by the press. And so Rome put their people right in place in the alternative media. And I believe you've got that with Jones and Mars and Monteith and some of these other people. They're leading people astray, Keith. They claim to be alternative media, which they are, but they only bring people to a certain point and then they drop them. And that's not fair, because all of these front groups, from the CFR to the Illuminati to the Jews to the bankers, Keith, there's always somebody behind them in the shadows.
That's right.
It's just the way it is. I had a lady from Scotland many years ago who, when she got my books over in Scotland, she said, I read them and I thought, this is ridiculous. Tony Blair, the leader of the United Kingdom, a puppet of the Jesuit order in the Catholic Church, she said, that's absurd. And she laughed. But you know what, Keith? She started watching. And every time, she said, when Tony Blair would get up to give a speech, she said she noticed in the background, a little bit behind him, there were some men in black robes. And she said, you know what? I stopped laughing.
Oh, yeah, no problem here. And also, I've come across stories about them in Newsweek back in 1949. I was looking for something else, believe it or not, in a library archives, and I came across basically a beauty piece on the Jesuits when Jansen was the Jesuit general, and that is the official title of the head of the Jesuits, and generalship is a term that should not be lost on folks, because as we said, the Jesuits are primarily and in the form of Loyola's, Ignatius Loyola's ideal, a military order. I want to thank you for coming on. I'm not going to ask you anything more, Bill, because you said that you would love to have come on again. You are unable to be with us live here this Friday. And I think I'd like to pick this up, if we could, at another time. Is that all right with you?
Keith, I'd be happy anytime. Let me know.
All right. I thank you for the time today, and we'll be talking very shortly.
Very good, Keith. God bless.
Okay, that was, of course, the interview. I wanted to point something out to the listeners out there, too. The tag or the files that were spoken of are posted over on the Watchman Live site. That's watchman-live.net. And they're also posted on the chat room page. For those of you who are already in the chat room, you can just scroll up to where the graphic is for the show, and you'll see the links there that say Vatican Bibliography and Seldes. These are both Word docs, so you can pick those up as well right off the website. So we're going to post some of this other stuff as well after the show, going up with the podcast. Back to you, Keith.
All right, just one quick quote from Hughes' book, The Enemy Unmasked. One of the major purposes of the Jesuits was to destroy every trace of Protestantism and its principles, including religious freedom.
Bill, I have to ask you, I mean, you've written two books. You could have written about anything, but you wrote about...
...around a strong middle class. Another purpose of the Jesuits was to greatly expand the power and control of the papacy throughout the entire world. Now, there's another spiritual component that's attached to this that we'll cover in the second hour. But right now, what I wanted to do was first throw it to Gordon to discuss some of the machinations of the Vatican and the Jesuits in Europe in earlier times, and then also in later times. Larry, you'll take it from Gordon, and we'll go through some of the more modern-day 20th century instigations. So, Gordon, you want to take it away right now?
Yeah, it's just astonishing what evangelical churches, what they don't know about history anymore. And it just, it used to be common knowledge. It's astonishing what has been whitewashed, what has been memory-holed. There is one, you'd probably have to ask a Protestant, somebody who's gone to seminary or something, but ask them, hey, have you ever come across the name J.A. Wiley? And they'll probably say yeah, and they've read a little bit of him, but they don't understand the import of him. J.A. Wiley, in the 1800s, was, and he still is, tremendously respected historian, a Protestant historian. That's back when they used the term Protestant still. And he wrote a series of books, the whole volume. All of them are called, I think, The History of Protestantism, and one of them's on the papacy. And another one is called The History of the Waldenses. And if you read that and find out what Rome did to these people who were Christian people living in the valleys in the Alps north of Rome, you will get disgusted. You will be greatly sickened at what Rome did to these people. It was barbaric. They tried to exterminate them. These were people who traced their lineage, the Waldenses. They traced their lineage, if not to the apostles directly, at least to the generation right after the apostles, and they kept the scriptures alive, the real scriptures, the ones that we get the King James Bible from today. They kept that alive, and Rome wanted rid of them. And they almost pulled it off. At one point, they had the whole Waldenses down to 800 survivors. But there was a people next door to them called the Albigenses. And see, we're told today on like the Hitler Channel or the Discovery Channel, if you, any mainstream history source, we're told that the Albigenses were like quasi-New Age prototypes. Well, and they linked them up with the Cathars, or maybe even they're equated with the Cathars. Well, if you read J.A. Wiley, according to J.A. Wiley, the Albigenses were Christians. And they were exterminated, except for just a very few struggling survivors. And here's a tip-off that the Albigenses were Christian. Where did they flee to? The last, probably just a few dozen of them, where did they flee to from Rome? They fled to the Waldenses, the valleys of the Waldenses. That's a sign that the Albigenses were Christian, likely. But according, again, J.A. Wiley says they were, not New Agers. And then you had and this has been totally expunged from history, just about. We know very little about them. It was so successfully eradicated. The North African Church. Apparently, from what little we know, there was a thriving, teeming North African Church for just a brief few centuries there after Christ. And all across Northern Africa, they were real Christians, and they were exterminated. Now, it was Islam that did the exterminating, but if you listen to this guy named Dr. Alberto Rivera, who claimed to have, there's a lot of controversy about him, he claimed to have been a Jesuit who gave up Jesuitism and became born again, became a true believer in Christ. And Dr. Alberto Rivera's story, who was later assassinated, by the way, that's another tip-off that Rivera was probably telling the truth. Rivera said that within the walls of the Vatican, it is known that the Vatican begat Islam for certain reasons, but it eventually turned into a kind of a Frankenstein's monster that they couldn't control, and that was the reason for the Crusades, or one reason. Islam was supposed to hand over the Holy Land to Rome, but Islam decided to keep it for itself, and that's when the Pope at that time went ballistic. But anyway, they sicked Islam after the Northern Christian Church and wiped them out. All right, moving on in history. It goes on and on, by the way, and it's all the same mother of harlots doing the extermination of Christians. You got after the Reformation, and the Waldenses were really the pioneers of that Reformation, the 800 survivors, you had what happened in France, the Huguenots. And what their history is really tragic. There's actually an excellent movie, rather recent, you can watch about it, called Queen Margot. And there was what was known as the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre in the late 1500s, where there was a Protestant king, was a Protestant French, I'm sorry, yeah, Protestant French king, I believe, was supposed to wed a Catholic queen, either that or their prince and princess, whatever, but it was a Catholic and a Protestant match, and it was going to establish religious, go far towards establishing religious freedom in France, which at that time was just really in strife over the Huguenots. They were really on the rise numerically, the Protestants in France. So what happened was they had a great big wedding. Everybody was invited. The Jesuits invited everybody to that wedding. It was going to be a time of peace. It was time where they were going to supposedly put the nation of France first. Instead, on the night before the wedding, the Jesuits got out their long knives and murdered all of the Protestants, with the exception of, I think, Prince Henry, I think was his name, Henry of Navarre, he was going to be the French king, the Protestant. But they even murdered the leading Protestant at the time named Gaspard Coligny. He was an admiral in the French Navy. He was a member of the royal court in France. He was tremendously respected. He was a brilliant military tactician, already established. They murdered him. They sacrificed him through treachery, and basically they sunk France. They put France, this is one huge reason why you see France losing all the wars of the colonial era to England. They ate themselves. The Jesuits did it, but their leaders, the Huguenots were, those that weren't assassinated were banished from the country, had to flee overnight. And the Huguenots were largely skilled craftsmen, and France just suffered economically in a huge way after that. But that was okay for the Jesuits, and that they didn't care about France. You look over next door with Germany, the 30 Years' War that ravaged Lutheran Germany, that was instigated and exacerbated by Rome, by the intriguers of Rome. Then you have the incessant plots to kill Queen Elizabeth, and they go on and on. This is when you get the Spanish Armada. Who was it that put, King Philip of Spain? Who put him up to send the Spanish Armada against England? Why, of course, Rome put him up to it. But then you had the Babington plot at that time, and you had the Lee Harvey Guy Fawkes plot to blow up Parliament. All of that happened during Queen Elizabeth. All of it was the instigation of the Society of Jesus. Also at that time was going on, or maybe a little bit before, you had, this is when Protestant Holland was dominated, brutally dominated by Catholic Spain, again, at the instigation of who, you guessed it, and in Scotland, and in England too. When you had Queen Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary, for a time, England had even been very torn over this. It's just wherever this society goes, wherever Rome goes, and their master intriguers or the Society of Jesus, it causes mayhem everywhere. I mean, I'm real quick. I'm reading a book right now, another book by Avro Manhattan, and he's covering the Latin American history of the late 20th century. And basically, when you hear about everything going on with the Contras and Nicaragua and the Allende regime and the Pinochet regime in Chile and all of these recent revolutions in Latin America, they're all instigated by the Jesuits. I mean, Avro Manhattan's telling you how, and the details, they're astonishing, but it's all there. Anyway, it goes on and on. But then you get to the 20th century, okay? Going back, once you get into the 20th century, you have the Vatican embracing fascism at that point and setting up, Larry knows this ground even more than I do, that the concordats that were just this ugly history that, a lot of Christians or a lot of people want to just poo-poo, like, oh, yeah, Pope Pius XII, he made this agreement with Hitler and with Mussolini, and then, boy, he regretted it later on, and doggone it, oops. And, well, but then, okay, what happened, though, during World War II in Yugoslavia was so barbaric, so disgusting, that it even sickened the SS, the assassins within the SS, within the Reich. They were even grossed out by what the Yugoslavian, the Croatian Ustashi pulled off, the Holocaust against 500,000 Serbs in Yugoslavia. And you know who carried that out? It was bands of Ustashi led by Franciscan monks. And their dictator at the time, Ante Pavelić, he met regularly with Pope Pius XII, and then you're going to get into the rat lines. But Larry, you take it from there because you know more about that than I do.
Okay, thank you, Gordon.
Hold on, I'll tell you what. Hold on, Larry.
Yeah.
You're going to hate me. No, we're at the top of the hour, so why don't we take a break, and when we come back,
yeah, we're going to do that.
Then we'll have Larry fill us in on the latter part of where Gordon had started, if that's okay.
Yep, that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break here about 5 minutes or so. You folks on the stream may get a gap of silence as we flip the stream off of the studio over to the music playlist. And don't be alarmed by that. This is The Watchman Live. I'm Randy Moggins with Gordon Comstock, Larry the Contractor Guy, and Visigoth. And we are doing Vatican exposure, talking about the Vatican and the Jesuits. And you're not hearing a lot of me in this show because my role tonight is as producer and really to learn, because I'm still in this really steep learning curve. So with those brief comments, we're going to head out of here. We'll be back in about 5 minutes. Folks in the chat room, just hang out, and we will return very shortly.
Speed of over 17,000 miles per hour. The musical selections you're about to hear were first tape recorded and fed into a transmitter where they were beamed to Relay 2 spacecraft. As you listen to the musical selections, note the clarity and excellent stereophonic separation between the left and right channels, even after traversing 12,000 miles.
back. This is The Watchman Live. I think we're back on the streams as well. Correct me if I'm wrong. Well, you wouldn't be able to hear me, would you? It's wonderful. Anyway, we're back. This is The Watchman Live. I'm Randy Moggins. I have with me Visigoth, Gordon Comstock, and Larry the Contractor Guy from Austin, Texas. This is Vatican Exposures, I think we've titled this. And for those of you who want to get in touch with us, we're going to take some phone calls probably at the bottom of this half hour. And you can also email blast us through Visigoth at hotmail.com. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's V-Y-Z-Y-G-O-T-H.
There you go. There you go. And let's see, we were going to toss this over to Larry now, weren't we?
Yeah, Gordon was going to give some time for those who might want to read about what he had just been speaking to.
Fair enough.
All right, this is just a small sample of what's on that list that's accessible to the listeners. And this is from all over the historical period, but started out with the one that goes back the oldest. The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. He traces Mystery Babylon, Mother of Harlots. He traces it all the way back to the original Babylon with Nimrod and his queen Semiramis. And a lot of that book today is criticized by modernists and Rome because Hislop filled in a lot of the gaps with conjecture. But that book is so scholarly written that the language is so erudite. Hislop was extremely educated, and what you'll find that his conjecture makes a lot of reasonable sense, combined with the concrete facts he gives you. There are wooden engravings of like the goddess and the infant, the Madonna and the infant, but they're like from hundreds of years ago and from cultures in Asia. The whole mother goddess thing, it goes way back, and stuff like that throughout the whole book, and it's global and all throughout history. Now, go much more contemporarily. The book that I have found that the best, when people ask me for a book about eschatology, the one that I always recommend because it's very succinct, very easy to read, and really explains it well, is End Time Delusions by Steve Wahlberg. Now, he is a Seventh-day Adventist, but he doesn't get into his peculiar Seventh-day Adventist stuff at all in that book. So just that book alone is a safe book to read. It's fantastic. It explains really the historicist position of eschatology, which is the forgotten position nowadays.
Let me interject something there.
Yeah, yeah.
You just mentioned Wahlberg and the fact that he's a Seventh-day Adventist, and of course we've heard criticisms of almost everybody that has done this type of research, usually based on their religious background, their own biases and prejudice. And that's fair criticism, but at the same time, part of research is to be able to dig out critical information and disregard what may be opinion, either inferred or directly injected into the works. And you know, it's not useful if you're looking for truth to just disregard verifiable facts.
Yeah.
Based on the fact that somebody has a particular background or even a particular prejudice or even is perhaps, you know, in some way personally offensive to you.
Yep. Okay. Next. I totally agree, Randy. Next, if Americans want to know, everybody's always scratching their heads about Vietnam. Why did we go to Vietnam? Avril Manhattan's book, Vietnam, Why Did We Go? He tells you why the U.S. went to Vietnam, the culprit behind it all was Rome. You don't believe it? Read the book. And then The Vatican's Holocaust by Avril Manhattan tells about stupid Americans, historically bereft. Everybody scratched their heads about what was happening in the 90s in Bosnia. Well, it's totally explainable, even though it goes back to before this, but if you read The Vatican's Holocaust by Avril Manhattan, this is the forgotten Holocaust, and again, the events there that happened, the atrocities were so disgusting it even repulsed the SS, and Rome was behind it. Then you want to find out who murdered Abraham Lincoln. The book Transformation of the Republic by Charles Wilcox, that book proves that the Society of of Jesus murdered Abraham Lincoln. I repeat, it proves...
Yes.
The Jesuits killed Abraham Lincoln.
Absolutely.
It proves that. Okay, moving on. And the other books that do that as well. The Suppressed Truth of the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln by Burke McCarthy, that also proves it, but that was written in the 1920s. Here's something interesting about that one. Written in, I think, 1924, this author, Burke McCarthy, she just throws out this little sidebar that the Jesuits are currently in Japan fulminating a coming war between Japan and the U.S. She wrote that in 1924. Okay, moving on. Also, another book that proves that the Jesuits murdered Lincoln is The Rome's Responsibility for the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln by Brigadier General Thomas Harris. How did Thomas Harris know about the facts of that case? Very simple. He was there. He knew Abraham Lincoln. He was part of the military tribunal that tried the conspirators here, and he knew who was behind them. You want to know how Rome had its hands in the formation of this country? Read right from the start. Read The Grand Design. The Grand Design by John Daniel. There's another book I would recommend called Hitler's Pope by John Cornwell. And Randy, here you go with gleaning information.
Mm-hmm.
This book, Cornwell himself is a Catholic, self-professed Catholic, and all throughout the book, he is scratching his head. All throughout the book, he's mystified as to how Pius XII would be so complicit in what Hitler was doing. And he thinks it's because Pius XII was the puppet of Hitler. The book, but what he doesn't realize is the book only makes sense if you reverse it, and the book should be called The Pope's Hitler, and that Hitler is the puppet of Pius XII.
Yeah.
Don't read the whole bibliography, Gordon.
All right.
Hold yourself down. Look
yeah,
back.
There we go.
Yeah, I could go on and on.
Yeah, you are. Okay, and without further ado, it's all yours, Larry.
Okay, well, speaking of Pius XII, I'd like to read something from Edmund Paris' blockbuster book, The Secret History of the Jesuits. Edmund Paris was a French historian who wrote a very long and scathing history of the Jesuit order. He says, the Jesuit father, Tati Venturi, the general secretary of the company, served as a middleman between Pius XI, whose confessors are Jesuits, and Mussolini. The Pope in February 1929, at the time of the Treaty of Lateran, calls Mussolini the man whom Providence allowed us to meet. Rome does not condemn what is commonly called the Ethiopian aggression. And in 1940, the Vatican is still Mussolini's sincere friend. The Jesuits have their secret abode in it. From there, they survey the universal church with a cold and calculating eye of the politician. And he says that's the perfect summary of the Jesuit activity between the two world wars. The Pope seemed to identify himself too much with the dictators, wrote M. Francois Charles Roux, who was the French ambassador to the Vatican at that time. And Paris says, but could it be otherwise when the Holy See itself had raised these men to power? Mussolini, the prototype, was inaugurator of that series of providential men, these sword bearers, who would prepare the revenge for 1918. From Italy, where it prospered so well under the care of the Jesuit father, Tachi Venturi, and his acolytes, fascism was soon to be exported to Germany. Hitler receives his impetus from Mussolini. The ideal of the Nazis is the same as in Italy. Since Mussolini is at the head, all the sympathies are for Berlin. In 1923, his fascism merges with National Socialism. He becomes friends with Hitler, to whom he supplies arms and money. At that time, Monsignor Pacelli, future Pius XII, and then the Curia's best diplomat, is a nuncio in Munich, capital of Catholic Bavaria. There, the star of the future German dictator starts to rise. He's also a Catholic, like his most important associates. Of that contrary cradle of Nazism, M. Maurice Laporte tells us, its two enemies are called Protestantism and democracy. Prussia's anxiety is therefore understandable. It is easy to guess what kind of special care the Vatican gives Bavaria, where Hitler's National Socialism recruits his strongest contingents. To take from heretic Prussia the control of the German secular arm, and transfer it to Catholic Bavaria. What a dream. Monsignor Pacelli puts all his power in realizing it and acting in concert with the chief of the Company of Jesus. Well, basically what Edmund Parris is trying to tell us there is that fascism was very much an invention and not necessarily an invention, but was definitely financed and by the Vatican and the two men that were to take their place as the two major fascist dictators in Europe were groomed by the Vatican and the Jesuits. Gordon was speaking earlier about the rat lines and also about Croatia. And as far as the rat lines go, the man that was most instrumental in the rat lines, which was a basically a situation where war criminals were actively sought out and gotten out of Europe into other countries. And the man that was behind that was, I'll read from a book called A Woman Rides the Beast by Dave Hunt. One of the early key figures directing the escape of Nazi war criminals and especially Catholic clergy was Bishop Alois Hudal, rector of a seminary for German priests in Rome and a close associate of both Monsignor Giovanni Montini, later Pope Paul VI, and Alcide de Gasperi, later the Italian premier. Confidant also of Eugenio Pacelli, both before and after he became Pius XII, Hudal was as fanatical in his support of Hitler and Nazi policies as he was in his hatred of anything communist. An unrepentant anti-Semite to his death, Hudal worked closely in Rome with the Holy Office, successor to the Inquisition, to watchdog over Catholic doctrine. Hudal saw no conflict between his beloved Roman Catholicism and his equally beloved Nazism. During the war, he proudly drove around Rome displaying a Greater Germany flag on his car until an Allied victory was inevitable. Then it was hastily removed. Hudal's pro-Nazi speeches in Rome, his pro-Nazi book, The Foundations of National Socialism, which was given the imprimatur by Cardinal Theodor Enitzer, who was the primate of the Austrian Catholic Church, who welcomed Hitler enthusiastically when he invaded Austria, by the way, far from being frowned on by the Vatican, seemed rather to earn his approval. Close associate of the Vatican's Secretary of State, Cardinal Eugenio Maria Pacelli, who later became Pope Pius XII on March 2, 1939, Hudal was elevated to the titular bishop in 1936 in a ceremony presided over by Cardinal Pacelli himself. Equally favored by the Nazis, Hudal held a golden Nazi party membership badge. This was the man who started the rat lines, the escape line by which many Nazi war criminals were able to get out of Europe and escape from being judged for their crimes. And here's from the same source. The rat lines began with diplomatic pressure applied by Pius XII to allow his personal representatives to visit prisoner of war camps to minister religiously to Catholics, in quotation. The real purpose was to identify and smuggle out Nazi war criminals. It can hardly be a coincidence that the man Pius XII chose to head this outrageous obstruction of international justice was his close advisor, Bishop Hudal, whom almost all of Rome knew was a fanatical anti-Semite and pro-Nazi. As Hudal himself later frankly admitted, "I thank God that he has allowed me to visit prisons and concentration camps and to help prisoners escape with false identity papers. I felt duty-bound after 1945 to devote my whole charitable work mainly to former National Socialists and fascists, especially to so-called war criminals." In other words, Hudal really didn't think these people were war criminals since he was pro-Nazi. Hunt goes on to say, "The criminality of the Hitler regime had so outraged the world that an international tribunal had been assembled in Nuremberg to try those responsible for war crimes. Yet Bishop Hudal, knowing the facts, declared with the conviction of a man who believes he has served God well that his charitable work had mainly consisted in rescuing war criminals from the justice the rest of the world wanted to impose upon them. Did Hudal act alone? Indeed not. he faithfully carried out a secret mission in service of the Pope and his beloved church. After he was replaced, that work continued under Vatican sponsorship. The new men in charge were even more overtly evil than Hudal. Like him, they were Catholic clergy who believed that they were serving God and knew that they had the Pope's blessing. Thus, Hudal's incredible words about charitable work and rescuing war criminals are really the words of the Vatican that was behind this operation. It's just incredible to me that anybody who is claiming to be a Christian could possibly be involved in spiriting out war criminals out of Europe so that they could escape justice. But that's exactly what this man did and others under his charge. But eventually, Hudal's reputation kind of became a problem for the Vatican. So further in the book, Hunt says, Hudal's open espousal of Nazism, his outspoken admiration for Hitler, and his unabashed anti-Semitism continued even after the war ended and the unfathomable evil of the Holocaust had been revealed to a horrified world. As a result, the bishop eventually became an embarrassment to the Vatican. He was drawing public attention with threatened exposure of the rat lines. Consequently, his superiors brought pressure upon Hudal to step out of the picture. Reluctantly, he retired from his ecclesiastical positions and faded into the background. Thereafter, the supervision of the rat lines fell upon the shoulders of a resourceful Croatian Catholic priest, Father Krunoslav Drakonovic. In Croatia, he had been the close assistant to Bishop Sarek of Sarajevo, a notorious anti-Semite known as the Hangman of the Serbs. Church officials had called Drakonovic to Rome in August 1943, where he became Intermarium's most influential contact to the Vatican. Many of Drakonovic's former associates in the Ustasi, including a number of Catholic priests, such as Father Willem, I can't pronounce the man's name, excuse me, were listed as war criminal number 7103 by Tito's government and unsuccessfully sought for extradition, were key figures in operating the rat lines. They're already referred to as responsible for the Austrian end of the rat lines, served as a military chaplain and performed absolution for Ustashi forces during the height of the massacre of the Serbs and the Jews. It's incredible, but Ante Pavelić, who was one of the higher-ups in the Croatian government, one of the men who was overseeing, some people can call him the Croatian Fuhrer, he was hidden inside one of the Pope's summer homes. These people not only massacred huge numbers, but they were completely sheltered by the higher ups within the Vatican. It says here that again with Dave Hunt, the Nazis fulfilling the Vatican's desire declared Croatia to be an independent nation and set up Ante Pavelić as the head of their puppet regime. Pavelić immediately launched his extermination program. His friend Stefan Heffer was made governor general of the country of Marana, where he zealously enforced the Ustasha Creed. It meant that the slaughter of the Serbs and the deportation of the Jews to Nazi death camps was official state policy carried out by vigilante bands of Croatian terror squads that traveled the hills and valleys in search of non-Catholic families. In other words, it was a wholesale campaign of murder against anyone who was not Roman Catholic. It's a terrible time in history, but it was sanctioned by the higher ups within the Vatican.
But that's a recurring pattern in history all throughout.
Right. There was an attempt to expose the rat lines in 1994 on a primetime live television show with Sam Donaldson. It's called The Last Refuge, and the program was shot both in Argentina and Rome and offered some of the information that I've been talking about. And the entrance into Argentina, the Nazi war criminals coming down the rat lines was documented. But when they confronted Roman Catholic officials with this, they were given a lot of excuses and said, well, you know, an awful lot of people were trying to get out of Europe at that time. There was an awful lot of refugees, and gosh, we just didn't know, and nobody knew. And they said, well, maybe one or two got by, and Donaldson said there were thousands. And the Vatican representative, a man named Father Robert Graham, who was a church historian, said, well, please, you know, don't be ridiculous. 1,000, that's absurd. And when Donaldson persisted, he kept giving more evidence. He said, well, you're just very simple and unsophisticated and really don't know what you're talking about there. But it was just a...
Well, Larry?
Yes.
A lot of them, they didn't just go to Latin America. They went to the U.S. and Canada.
Oh, yeah. That's true. That's correct. It's really, I don't think anybody has accurate records as to just how many of them got out, but they know it has to be into the thousands because, you know, just the sheer volume. And some of the worst war criminals of that period got out through the Vatican rat lines of people like Klaus Barbie, Adolf Eichmann, Heinrich Mueller, and Franz Stangl, who were all...
Mengele?
Yeah, Mengele got out that way. Tremendous number of people. There's a book called Into That Darkness by Gitta Sereni, and it described how Bishop Hudal was expecting Stangl. He expected over 100 war criminals, and that he was arranging papers, passport, an exit visa, and work permits for South America. Hudal arranged Stangl's sleeping quarters, his transportation via car, plane, ship, and seemed to have plenty of money for payoffs and bribes. And Hudal had made contacts with the German Red Cross, the American Office of Strategic Services, British intelligence, and even seemed to be well connected to the Nazi escape organizations of Odessa and Despina.
Hey, Larry, I'm sure you know this, but and this is covered in Unholy Trinity. The author's name is Aaron's last name.
Yeah.
The Red Cross, they used the Red Cross big time. They had there was a bishop who was working with the Red Cross to set them up with phony paperwork.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've read that, too. I have read Unholy Trinity. It's John Loftus, who is a Catholic, and Mark Aarons, who is an Australian. He may be a Jew. I'm not sure about his background, but I did think it was interesting that Loftus, being a Roman Catholic himself, would write this book, which was a terrific expose. One thing I'd like to talk about, if I've got time, just for a little bit, is about George Seldes and his experiences during the Spanish Civil War. And here, according to Seldes, he wrote a series of articles in a magazine called The Churchman, which is an Episcopalian church magazine. He wrote these during the 70s. He was getting very elderly at that time. He's probably in his 70s at that time. And he said, the war correspondents, not only Matthews and Hemingway, but the 100 or more without exception, tried to tell the world from Madrid that this was a rehearsal by Hitler and Mussolini for a world war. We said so in 1936 and every year until 1939. We warned FDR and France and England that the Nazi fascists masquerading as anti-communists were trying out guns, tanks, and airplanes. There was destruction of whole cities, air bombing in Guernica, destruction of whole civilian population, Barcelona block bombing. We tried to tell the world to prepare for the Hitler-Mussolini-Japanese anti-comintern pack attack, which is now known as World War II, and by preparing, perhaps prevent it. We failed largely, get this, because of pressure by the Roman Catholic Church of the United States on the American press, by Father Thorning, Cardinal Spellman, and others. And being the most powerful opinion-making paper in America, the Times, talking about the New York Times, must share a major part of the blame. Three estates, rulers, army, church had at least confessed their sins, but not the infallible Times. I've got another quote I'd like to read about Seldes. In 1931, Spain became the Republic of Spain, a liberal democracy that separated church and state, ended state monetary support for the church, and adopted the principles of freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, and freedom of the press. The Vatican feared for the church's very survival in Spain. There had been four insurrections since 1835, and it was the Spanish people, the poor workers and poor peasants, who burned the churches because they blamed the hierarchy for having persistently backed the upper class. The Spanish Civil War of 1936-39 is often called a civil war, but this was a lie from the beginning. It was not a civil war, but an invasion by Hitler, Mussolini, and Salazar fascists. Mussolini, and he says in Rome in 1934, Mussolini and two representatives of the plan met there and even promised help in overthrowing the Republic and establishing a fascist type of government. They also met with Hitler that same year, and the confessions of the Nazis at the Nuremberg trials confirmed the plot. There was to be an uprising of treasonous Republic officers led by Franco, the invasion by the Italian and German forces, and the promulgation of the lie that this was an uprising against a communist takeover of the Republic and a Christian crusade against atheistic communism. The creation of this great lie would primarily be the responsibility of the Vatican. And that's from an article called Lies Not Meant for the Light in the Churchman magazine. There was a great deal of a great many articles that Seldes wrote in which he tried to tell the American public that the Roman Catholic Church was behind suppression of his articles and other people's articles, which displaying the real truth about what was going on in Spain, and that it was really not anti-communism that was really being done there. What it was is kind of a dress rehearsal for World War II, as you said.
Larry?
Yeah, sure.
There is that, I think it's Lords of the Press by George Seldes.
Yeah.
And he did write a few pieces about the suppression of the U.S. press from Rome, right?
Right, right.
Okay. Now, you take that, go back in time a little bit. Say, go back to the late 1800s and the book America or Rome, Christ or the Pope by John L. Brandt. He was vociferously warning Americans of Rome's takeover and suppression of the U.S. press. And you can take it back further than that. The two works by American inventor Samuel Morse around the early 1800s, he was warning the same thing even then.
Yeah. It's amazing that a newspaper with the prestige of the New York Times was basically shut down as far as its printing anything that was detrimental to the Roman Catholic Church. He talks about that quite a bit in his articles. In fact, I've got one right here from August 1978 that illustrates that point. It's from the Churchman magazine. It says The New York Times is still in fear of reprisals from the Roman Church in America, as it was during the entire Spanish War, when under managing editor Edward L. James, a notorious fascist phalanx in the bullpen, James IV, incidentally Roman Catholic, editor assistants, bowed to the powerhouse on Madison Avenue, Cardinal Spellman's residence. And a certain Father Thorning and published scores of falsifications from Spain. He says later on in the article, the New Republic, to its credit, and who lied about Spain when the war was over in 1939, listed the New York Times man with Franco as the number one falsifier. In a November 1981 article, Seldes concluded that all of America's 1,750 daily papers were similarly terrified by the Catholic Church propaganda campaign. This terror that Seldes described is still pervasive and has led to the disappearance of free press in America and matters of concern to the Vatican, such as a recognition of overpopulation as a national security threat. That's somebody's editorial comment. But it was clear when I started reading Seldes' work that he tried very hard to tell the American public about what was really going on in the Spanish Civil War, and that they were being fed a bill of goods, but he could not get this through. Many of his stories were suppressed and edited to the point where what he was trying to say just did not get across.
Yeah, all of these works, including this George Seldes guy, their works are extremely hard to find now.
Yeah, they are. I kind of had to dig around quite a bit to find any of this stuff. And it was really cool that I ran into this series of articles in this Episcopalian magazine, which incidentally I think is like almost 200 years old, or I said 200, more like 100 and something years old. But many of his articles were written when he was quite an elderly man, but the guy was still lucid. He lived to be, I think, 104 years old. He died in 1995. So he was he saw the whole 20th century, you know, practically the entire thing, and was considered one of the great writers. He had the distinction of being thrown out of Russia for criticizing the Bolsheviks, and also being thrown out of Italy for criticizing Mussolini. Well, he wrote a book called The Sawdust Caesar about Mussolini. It's not very flattering toward him. Very much an anti-fascist.
We want to. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. We want to get to the Charles Wilcox interview, and this is about 20 minutes. And I don't know if anybody on the chat room wants to call in. I know somebody asked me if I was taking calls. Let's go through the Wilcox interview, and I'll maybe entertain one call. Sorry, this probably wasn't a call-in show tonight in the classic sense, because we're really cramming the material. So with that, we're going to go ahead, and this is the pre-record of Visigoth with Charles T. Wilcox, who has, he's apparently been in the chat room off and on this evening. Anyway, let's go ahead with this part of the interview. And here we go. This is Charles Wilcox.
Charles, you're probably the author of the second book I read that had to do with the Vatican and the Jesuits, Phelps being the first one with his Vatican assassins. What I thought you did that was a great stroke was to include images of contemporary newspapers and such that obviously evinced some kind of concern over what they would call the Romanist influence in the United States. Now, can you tell me how you went about that? I mean,
oh, wow, it was a long process. One door closes and two more open, and through that entire process, I was directed to McGill University, and a professor Lougheed at McGill University, who was he had studied. Charles Chinnicky in depth, and it was through him that I was directed to a guy who had been in discussions at the time with a surviving relative of this Charles Chinnicky, and this relative had been sitting on a whole boatload of old newspapers and letters and on, all kinds of stuff, like hundreds of boxes of stuff. And he was able to get a hold of all this stuff from this relative, and I just asked him whether I could access the material that he had in his possession, which he acquiesced to, and then I had discussed with this relative of Chinnicky. Her name was Laura LaFave, by the way.
Okay.
And I called her and asked, I told her what I was doing, because it took a while. I mean, she had some questions, you know, thinking that I was maybe a spy or something. I don't know. But I finally got permission from both of them to go through this material and put it into a book that I had been contemplating doing at the time. So that's how I got a hold of that.
Also, you came upon the Harrison letters. I have that name correct, don't I?
Harris.
Harris, I'm sorry. Can you tell us what that was all about?
They were all that. That was all part and parcel of all that material.
It was there, okay.
Yeah, it was the letters from Brigadier General T.M. Harris, who was a member of the tribunal that the assassination tribunal of Lincoln's assassination, right?
Okay.
There was him, General. There was a whole bunch of them, but he was in correspondence with Charles Chinnicky at the time, and doing his history of the assassination, those letters were in there. Letters from Colonel Edwin Sherman, who was a Union officer, and he wrote a book on that whole affair, which I have up on my website, by the way, as a free PDF download.
That's the engineer Cor Appel, right?
That's right. Yeah, private letters from him to Chinnicky, private letters from Harris to Chinnicky. There was a letter from Louis Weichmann to Chinnicky. There were sworn statements of priests that were collected stating that they knew about Lincoln's assassination hours and days before it actually happened.
Yeah, what
and
was
they,
that?
And they had heard this in the middle of nowhere, Minnesota.
That's what I was going to ask you. It's been a while for me. As you know, I've just reordered the book. The first one I pass along, as I am wont to do, so I don't have it in front of me. Mm. But that it was always intriguing to me that in a time, well, the telegraph could have handled it somewhat, but still, there was this foreknowledge that at least the assassination was going to be attempted, and of course they were going to say successfully. So it was known, obviously, prior to that Friday night assassination, that there was going to be an attempt on Lincoln, correct?
It was known days before. As a matter of fact, one of the people who had filled out this these statements said that by that Friday evening at 6 o'clock in Minnesota, it was common knowledge. It was a public rumor by that time. So it was spread all over that part of Minnesota. And they also state that there was no rail or telegraph any nearer than 100 miles.
All right, so we can't attribute that to whatever communication modes they had then, huh?
According to Chinnicky, that the priests in that area had constant contact with their co-religionists in Washington. They were constantly coming and going. So I think he mentions in one of those letters that it was on the Wednesday previous. So that's like 2 or 3 days beforehand.
Refresh my memory. Is Chinnicky Canadian or was he U.S.?
He was Canadian.
U.S., I thought so. Okay.
But he was directed by the Pope to move to the Chicago area and set up a number of different colonies along the Mississippi, right? And so which he started to do. And it was during the process of that and his whole temperance thing that he came in major disagreement with the Irish priests of Chicago, who were busy getting drunk and having sex between themselves and hiring prostitutes and on and on and on. Not much different than what goes on now.
And Chicago.
Yeah, well, you know, and so they decided to get rid of him by laying a phony rape charge against him, and so he had to fight that charge in court, and his lawyer at the time was Abraham Lincoln.
Now, did they begin a relationship at that time, or so that Chinnicky actually had access to Lincoln during his presidency?
Yeah, that whole court case, that book by Sherman goes into certain aspects of that court case that are recorded nowhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And, that created and cemented a friendship between the Chinnicky and Lincoln that lasted all throughout Lincoln administration in the White House, so that Chinnicky came to visit him once a year and hang around for like a week or two, right? So they would go together once in a while to visit the soldiers in the field hospitals and stuff like that, right? And have their discussions on what Chinnicky had been finding out from his priest friends on how they were tweaking the war for their own ends.
And Chinnicky did warn him
several times.
Was it out of just,
friendship?
Well, but what I'm wondering about, did Chinnicky have hard knowledge that it was going to happen, or did he just say, look, you know, let's we all hear the drums in the jungle. I mean, we ought to be a little bit alert.
He heard specific plans.
Okay.
And warned him about it, and others were kind of a general nature, right? There were all kinds of assassination plans being cooked up in Baltimore, and Chinnicky was getting wind of an awful lot of them. And relaying that to Lincoln.
Could you hazard a guess, or do you know exactly what about Lincoln and what he did or didn't do angered the papacy?
Well, there are a few things. One, the Jesuits had in mind to establish a central bank and gain control of the money. This is like long before the Fed, right? Same idea, though. And he thwarted that. He knew that, the Rothschilds and you know, whoever else the Rothschilds were working for, all their agents, and that were working within the United States to gain financial control of the country. And Lincoln kind of thwarted that. They were also trying to establish, well, the European powers were trying to establish two separate democracies in place of one that would be self-sufficient, right? So two separate democracies that would be in debt to them. So he was trying to thwart that and got away with it to a large extent. And he had plans for, like, during the whole Reconstruction period, he had plans to bring the country back, like out from the authoritarianism that he was kind of forced to place during the war. And he wanted, like, just return everything back to the way things were, well, minus the slave thing, back to the way things were before the war broke out. And the European powers did not want that to happen. They wanted something else. And they started to get a lot of what they wanted through the Reconstruction process.
I think it's fair to say that the Confederacy ideal of returning back to some kind of states' rights above being part of a federated government, which is exactly what happened when they wrote the Constitution. I mean, I think a lot of the colonists now turned U.S. citizens were hoping just to be as sovereign as they could be. But with the writing of the Constitution, they realized they got federated under a central government, which I think most citizens didn't want to have happen. Okay, now we fast forward about 80, 90 years later, and we see the South probably hanging on to that hope. And it would seem to me, because it is a matter of record, that there were a lot of powers that did not want that war to end as, quote, quickly as it did, including some of Lincoln's own constituents, I wouldn't say constituents, but of his own political colleagues, known as the Radical Republicans, because they were making money and they didn't want to see it happen. So could I say that would it be correct to say that perhaps European powers were not so happy to see Lincoln be as conciliatory and as expeditious as he was trying to be?
Well, they were completely choked.
Okay.
Yeah, and they did not want that to happen. And they used the radical red Republicans to get what they wanted.
Yeah, Lincoln had a lot, you know, I tell you what, we always talk about the similarities between Lincoln and Kennedy, and one of them, which doesn't really get, I guess, well, as time goes by, people care less and less, but it would seem to me that both Lincoln and Kennedy, despite who had the hand of assassination, I mean, honestly, they just had so many enemies in so many sectors. You take a look at it, you got to think that neither one of them obviously had a chance to get out of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, Kennedy was pissing off a lot of people with, well, I mean, look what he wanted to do. Destroy the CIA, create constitutional money, and not involve the United States in foreign wars.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Lincoln was trying to do basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, not about the CIA, but he was trying to not have European interests be so well served, that they posed an immediate threat to the country, right? And that's what was happening. You had a lot of factions trying to get their own little chunk out of the United States and try to bring the U.S. in line to a more European system of government. And every time they tried, Lincoln was killing it. Right? So, yeah.
There are those who are very critical, and perhaps rightfully so. I would say that that's probably there, that Lincoln was, quote, a tyrant. Well, I don't know a tyrant, but you know, I'll just say that he did whatever he had to do that might have been politically expedient, and sometimes that doesn't wash too well, and I'm okay with that. I mean, both with Lincoln and Kennedy, I mean, let's face it, they all knew the deal. And I think at some point, and it's interesting also, that in 63, 18 for Lincoln and 19 for Kennedy, they may have had a change of heart, and wanted to basically scrap the plans they're given. As you know, presidents implement things. They don't really come up with them on their own. And that change of heart is not a good thing to do when you're a president.
They had so many things to contend. Yeah, I mean, he had to do things that he didn't want to, but he always had plans to reverse, you know, all those dictatorial things. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to call them that, right? And bring the country back in line to a more, the way it was originally intended.
Right. Well,
I have a quote from Otto von Bismarck.
Okay.
Right?
Go ahead.
He says, the division of the United States into federations of equal force was decided long before the Civil War by the high financial powers of Europe. Now, those financial powers are like the Rothschilds, who are also known as the guardians of the Vatican treasury.
The Vatican backers, yep.
Right, the Vatican bankers. These bankers were afraid that the United States, if they remained in one block and as in one nation, would attain economic and financial independence that would upset their financial domination over Europe and the world. Of course, in the inner circle of finance, the voice of the Rothschilds prevailed. They saw an opportunity for a lot of money if they could substitute two feeble democracies burdened with debt to the financiers in place of a vigorous republic sufficient unto herself. Therefore, they sent their emissaries into the field to exploit the question of slavery and to drive a wedge between the two parts of the Union. The rupture between North and South became inevitable, and the masters of European finance employed all their forces to bring it about and to turn it to their advantage. And that's a quote from Otto von Bismarck.
Wow. Can I ask you what year is that? Do you remember? 1879 or something like that?
I can't remember now.
That's okay. No, I mean, that's very eloquent and tells much. And I think it's also interesting, too, that Germany would later become the bad guy in two world wars. And I got to believe that was payment for, one, being the seat of where Protestantism or Reformation began, and also probably for what Bismarck said. I mean, you know, they pay for their views and their outspokenness. So, I don't know, you know, I've just been thinking about that lately, Charles, that why Germany being the bad guy in two world wars, and I think it's because that's still payback for the sin they committed back in the 16th century. That's just my guess. You know, you don't have to have any take on that, but
No, so far as that's concerned, but Europe has always been really, really choked with this whole concept of government of the people. I mean, Europe was like, what, nothing but one autocracy after another, after another, after another. And all of a sudden you've got, a bunch of upstarts in the U.S., coming out with, this Constitution and Bill of Rights that was completely the polar opposite of what was going on in Europe, and the Europeans, the leaders anyway, saw a direct threat to their own existence. Right, so they had to try to kill that as much as possible, and turn the government of the United States into something that more closely resembled what they had there. They're still trying.
Yeah, to this very day.
Yeah.
I'll just throw in that I think we're seeing the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire with the European Union. It's rudimentary right now, but it won't be for that much longer.
Mm-hmm.
Also, folks, you can go to ctwilcox.com. That's Charles' website. There's a lot of information there, as well as a chance to order the book, Transformation of the Republic. Last question to you, and it's rhetorical for me because we spoke about this many times across the years, but isn't it interesting that Europeans are very well aware, and as you told me, in Canada, you folks are very well aware, but somehow in the United States, there seems to be this amnesia when it comes to the concerns around the world about the Vatican / Jesuitical provocateuring in their nations.
Yeah, well, here is common knowledge. In Europe, it's common knowledge. In the United States, it's been removed from the collective national psyche.
Exactly.
And I think a part of that is due to the fact that In Europe, they have access to each other's and everyone else's media, so they know what the hell's going on. You can't hide anything. And here, we have access to the U.S. media in all of its forms. Whereas the United States, down in Florida, how many Canadian TV stations do you get in Florida?
That would be none.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing all over the U.S., right? Here, it's the polar opposite. We get not only our broadcasting and media, but yours as well, right? So that's the big difference. You're insulated.
You know, I would say the first election that I was cognizant of, and that would be presidential election, would be 60. And I just barely remember that, but I also remember reading the newspapers and listening to people talk that they were afraid that Kennedy would be a puppet for the Vatican. I thought it was almost a joke. You know, I thought it was some kind of hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was pretty much treated like that or meant to be treated like that. But I think what I was hearing and reading was the last whispers of those voices that remembered the way things were, especially in the 19th century, where there's a lot of this stuff, and it was valid. In fact, and we won't go into it now, I think Kennedy said enough that flew in the face of the Vatican, especially in that one speech he had in April of 61, as you remember. Yeah, it was April 61 when he talked about the monolith. Remember that? The monolithic conspiracy that you know, owns no armies but can avail itself of all.
I have that actually up on my site.
That's right. That's right. It's on your site. So I think, you know, again, people saying, well, he was talking about Russia. It's like, no, no, no. In the depth of the Cold War, he would have said it was Russia, and everybody would have, like, been right with it.
He said it goes beyond political...
Yes, without a doubt.
All that
right.
stuff.
Absolutely.
I mean, and if you take all of those ingredients, I guess, of what he was talking about, and try to apply it to a single entity... You only come up with one.
That's right. Well, again, I appreciate your time with us. And, of course, between you and me, I mean, we've done many, many hours across the years about this. But, you know, to capsulize for the purpose of this show that we're doing right now, I thank you for coming on. And we can't satisfy everybody's curiosity or perhaps suspicions or antagonisms. But if they're really concerned about finding the truth, they will. But so few really do. All right, Charles, thanks for being with us. Bill, I have to ask you, I mean, you've written two books. You could have written about anything, but you wrote about the Vatican, Jesuit influence.
Okay. And we're back. That was the interview with Charles T. Wilcox. And pardon me, I'm adjusting volume levels here because of the way our studio is set up. We got to feed to the hosts as well. A couple of comments. First off, I want to thank Charles for his work. And Keith, for the interview, it was Charles' book that really kind of gave me the awakening as to just how nefarious this whole Jesuit thing was, especially reading about the intrigues behind the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and the inflammation, the instigation that occurred prior to the Civil War, the war between the estates as well. One other thing, we're not going to take calls tonight, unfortunately. This remarkably rude little squid of a person was in our chat room, and he pissed me off, and I'm not going to give him airtime. I'm not going to give him the opportunity to display himself before public people, so we've blocked him in the chat room. You will get no airtime here. Go away. Get your own radio show. Go somewhere else and be a troll. Son of a bitch. Oh, this is Christian radio at its best, folks. Yeah, you get the gang stalkers. That's exactly what we have in there tonight. People with their own agenda. They don't want the truth. They just want to piss all over people that are trying to get the truth out.
That is the profile of a gang stalker, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. And I'm sorry, I can contain myself, and we should expect this. It's a sign that we're doing a good job. So I guess, gosh, thank you. You affirmed us. We're doing our job. We're being stalked. I appreciate that.
A couple things?
Yeah.
One, this guy put me on a list of people who are controlled opposition, and now I'm an agent. The stuff that he's written there, I'm telling you, I don't know where it comes from. I mean, it's sick. But here's my point. We were going to do an interview. He was going to be on my dime. And he said, oh, no, call the talk show number. And what he's going to do is basically turn the interview around on me. And I thought, we're not going to do that. Give me a private line. I'll call you. No callers, just you and me. And that never happened. And so he did what he wanted to do. And that's now the fact that he's been looking for this shows you that, you know, even though he's married, he probably doesn't have much to do, you know, with his life. So that's what that's about. No, I mean, you know, really, go howl at the moon or something, dude. So you go on with what you're going to go on with. But you're saying it doesn't mean I have to answer it. That just gets to be a real, you know, what should I call it, quicksand type of thing. Now, secondly, there was somebody in the chat room that was talking about Calvi. And I don't know about you guys, but my contention is that Godfather 3, although it wasn't as classic as the other two, if you will, actually addressed a number of issues that were going on in a way that I think that the targets did not like. There was a banking scandal, as was shown in that movie.
Right.
The Vatican banker Roberto Calvi was hung from a bridge in England, supposedly suicided. And that John Paul I got poisoned. And, you know, the thing about this is, you know, people can say, well, that's all allegations, blah, blah, blah. It's so much common knowledge that this has gone on. In fact, I had a laugh. I was watching some movie. I had no idea what it had to do with. And one of the quips was, well, you go ahead and do that, and you'll be the executive with the shortest tenure since John Paul I. Yeah, so, I mean, It's common knowledge what's going on out there. John Paul I was a righteous guy, wanted to ferret out all the corruption, and you can see what happened to him. But that's why I think Godfather 3 is never really embraced on TV. When American Movie Classics runs the, quote, trilogy, as they are wont to do like maybe 2-3 times a year, you might see Godfather once and as they cycle the marathon, maybe. It was on just recently. And we always crack up when we see it because it is. In fact, it was on ION. It wasn't even on AMC. It was on ION, but they do not like that movie. Sorry for that. Again.
And somebody in the chat room was also asking about connections between Freemasonry and the Society of Jesus. Well, they're not concrete connections, but how long did John Paul the first? Make it in the office. It was 33 days. There's your number 33. It also, and Diz, you brought this up, if you check out the DVD work, the video work of Dr. Walter Veith,
mm-hmm.
He has a lot of DVDs he's made, and on both, on Freemasonry and the Jesuits, and he shows you just how uncannily similar are the symbologies between
he claims that the Jesuits basically created the Masons. He shows a path of evidence or whatever, but I wasn't totally convinced, but I wouldn't put it past them.
There is one really ominous brief speculation in the book from the 1800s called The Master's Carpet by Edmund Ronayne, and this guy writes, he just speculates, he says, if the Vatican ever teamed up with Freemasonry, it would be unstoppable. This is a real brief, ominous line in that old book.
You know, the Catholic Church, on face, is always opposed to Freemasonry. And the story goes that's the reason why they had the Knights of Columbus. I don't know whatever all of that is true. I will say this, that as time's gone on, I think Freemasonry is being held out there as pretty much
a straw man.
Yeah, I mean, okay, fine, but you know, they got 33 degrees in a free right in the Scottish free right. I'm sorry, Scottish right Freemasonry. They have what, 13 in New York. All right, great. I'm not saying that there isn't something beyond that, and that's not known to a lot of us. But Freemasonry has been held out there pretty much as the originator of all these occult symbolisms and such, and it goes way back before that. Now, should Christians get involved in that? I don't think they should. You know, you're not to take an oath to anything else.
No.
But I do believe, though, that hitting Freemasonry is getting to be like, you know, smacking a rag doll.
You know, I was wondering about the connection. I've often heard it said that there is a connection between the Skull and Bone Society, that it is basically a Freemasonic society that came over from Germany. And I know that in their rituals, it's been exposed that they have a ritual when they're initiating the their pledges, where they have three figures. You know, one is one of the guys will dress up as the devil in, you know, little red devil outfit with the fork tail and all that, and then another guy dresses up as the Black Knight, and then another one dresses up as the Pope, which I always wondered if wasn't there kind of a way of mocking, you know, the Father and Son and the Holy Spirit type.
Yeah, you can sew that up even a little tighter, Larry. Skull and Bones not just originated in Germany, but in Bavaria, Germany. The Jesuit stronghold of Bavaria, which also gave us White Sophia.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that Bavaria figures large in the Jesuits' plans, and that, something a lot of people are not aware of, but it's come out in recent years that the person, it's known historically, it's factual, that Father Bernard Stample, who was a Jesuit priest, helped edit Mein Kampf. But Edmund Paris actually goes on to say that Stample wrote Mein Kampf, and it basically was a Jesuit document, you know, which they said, hey, this is what we want you, this is what we want you to do, sign your name here, Adolf, and he was happy with that. And they also had the help of an occult genius in Karl Haushofer, who was also a geopolitician, and there were some real heavyweight people behind the scenes that helped write Mein Kampf. And I really don't think Hitler, he was not an idiot by any means, he was an intelligent man, but I don't think he had the ability to write that well, and I don't think Mein Kampf's written that well for that matter, but the ideas expressed in it, I believe, were kind of some of his ideas plus what the Jesuits wanted to do.
Well, we can conjecture about a lot. We don't know, and I'm not saying it's not true. Don't get me wrong, Larry. But what we presented here and with the information in a lot of those books, if not all those books that we have put up on the bibliography, people can go make up their minds for themselves. You know, it's like somebody who's got a rap sheet with 27 offenses on them, and they go down through every one and say, oh, I was a bad judge on that one. No, there was a false witness on that one. Yeah, okay, 27 raps, you know.
Let me throw one more book out there, Biz.
Sure.
Herb Smith's going to want... He was asking me about this.
Yes, he did. Well, yeah, that's right.
See, some people might wonder, okay, what's the connection between the international bankers and the Jesuits? Okay, read The Federal Reserve Conspiracy and the Rockefellers by Emanuel Josephson. He will show you connections between the Jesuits and the Rockefellers.
Yeah, and then he gets vetted as being a Jew. You see, that's the kind of stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
It's all ad hominem attacks. And when you go for that kind of thing, then you get nothing. And again, that's the way it goes. Go check it out for yourself. That's all we can say. But it is the biggest shadow conspiracy the world has ever known.
I got a question in the chat room here. Interested one asks, ask Gordon if he knows the real name, quotes, of the Universal Church, please. I don't know what that means.
No, not, doesn't ring a bell.
Okay, interested one, if that was you go ahead and you can shoot me an answer back on that, because I'm not sure where that's going.
Elaborate a little more, yeah.
Yeah, give us a little more information.
Yeah, because there's a lot of universal churches, and some of them are involved in unity. It's ringing a bell for some reason, but yeah, you have to get more explicit.
Yeah, well... we will, you know, just to touch on that a minute, let's face it, the Vatican is the architect, ultimately, of universalism on some level. Their goal through ecumenism is to link all the churches together, which they've kind of been successful at in many different ways.
World Council of Churches.
Well, the World Council of Churches is one front from that. There was actually an earlier one, pre-World War II, and then the World Council of Churches picked it up in 1947. But there is a lot of, and I'll give you a case in point, the charismatic churches, which we think of as being Protestant, and you know, you can take that for what it's worth or not, are actually heavily infiltrated by Catholic doctrine as well. You have Rick Joyner, who is a member of the Knights of Malta, one of the most prominent figures in the third wave prophetic Kansas City movement. He's now restoring that reprobate Todd Bentley that had those revivals down in Lakeland. And I mean, Joyner makes no bones about the fact that he's a member of this group.
Right.
So there's even 6 degrees of separation anymore. They've tightly knitted in. Yeah.
There's so many topics there.
Consider, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the infiltration, the undermining of God's Word. All those people you just mentioned, Randy, are carrying around bogus Bibles that came from two documents, which came from where? Came from ultimately the Vatican.
Mm-hmm. Vaticanus manuscripts.
You know, we didn't touch upon that, Gordon. You said that you wanted that. And that is, we talk to people, or we do shows or interact with people in a secular vein, and we refer to what's coming as the New World Order. And that's true. But there's also a spiritual side of that for those who want to go there, and that is how it aligns with what's in Scripture, especially as it regards the prophesied satanic takeover for whatever period of time before, Christ comes back.
You know, the other thing that came up in the chat room earlier, and I can't, it's hard to track all the comments, especially when I had a provocateur in there, the idea of, how we wind up moving from the Jesuits into basically the whole Jewish thing as well. And I think what gets lost in this conversation is the fact that, look, at the end of the day, it's all satanic. It's all spiritual.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And all of these threads have been woven over a very long course of history. There are infiltrators on every front. There are double agents. The Church of Rome itself is basically a two-headed, it's a Janus. Mm-hmm. You have the religious side of it, and you have the political side of it. And this is a concept that not many people wrap their minds around, is how did we get to the place where we had this thing that calls itself the Church of Jesus Christ on the Earth, run by a man who says that he is, in fact, basically the surrogate Messiah operating in the office of the Pope, which is not in Scripture. I mean, the whole thing. And then on the other side of it, they've got, you know, a governmental structure that operates, banking operations, military orders, and all the other things that the Bible told us we were not supposed to do as believers. What part of this do we not get?
This is, to me, the one area where the book of Revelation gets really almost crystal clear. In Revelation 17, you have the woman arrayed in purple and scarlet, and Rome is known for the woman Mary, and their colors are purple and scarlet, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. That's Rome. That's the papal garb, having a golden cup in her hand, the Eucharist. The cup is full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. Think of all the priestly pedophilia. Well, and upon her forehead, Mystery Babylon, and she's drunk with the blood of the saints. There is not an institution on earth that has killed more Christians than Rome.
Well, I mean, it's clearly identified when the angel says, I'll tell you, you know, the interpretation of this is the woman which you saw is that great city which sits on seven hills. Well, excuse me, but that's Rome. And all through Christian history, Rome has been identified with Babylon in the spiritual sense. I think Jerome, Saint Jerome, back, gosh, around 400 something, wrote a very long treatise on that, and identified, you know, pagan Rome as the Babylon, it's always been identified with that. And I mean, even the colors that they talk about in the Bible, you know, purple and red, the scarlet and purple, well, that's associated with the papacy.
Dave Hunt, rightfully, isn't it? This is the title of his book. It calls it The Woman Riding the Beast.
Yeah.
Okay.
A woman rides the beast. Correct.
A woman rides the beast. Okay, let me just read this really brief, it's like five sentences, brief paragraph from Avro Manhattan. He's talking about the Vatican political maneuvers in the first half of the 20th century. He writes, "The pattern has been one of historical consistency. Early in this century, the Vatican sided with the empires of monarchical Europe. After World War I, it sustained the fascist dictatorships. Following World War II, it fanned the Cold War by supporting the U.S. against Soviet Russia. After the Vietnam War, it sided with Soviet Russia against the U.S. In the 80s, it has struck up another working partnership with the U.S. That is the woman riding the beast in the 20th century."
Right. Really, in one sense, the Roman Catholic Church is just the Roman Empire in a different form. I mean, it changed forms, and it's still searching to get back to the point where it's both a religious and a political, economic empire, just and a military power, just as the old Roman Empire was. And I think that's something they've been searching for an awful long time. That's what the Holy Roman Empire was an attempt to get back to the Roman Empire. And then you had the Third Reich, and before that you had the Second Reich or the German Kaisers. And it's going to culminate in its final form in the European Union, just as Viz says. I think that's pretty clear to me that that's going to be the final revived Roman Empire.
Yeah, I just did a show largely about John Hagee. And it's astonishing to see a guy like John Hagee, and he's ultimately serving the purpose of Rome.
Mm-hmm. In a sense, yes. I can see what you're saying.
Well, John Hagee has alliances with people, Newt Gingrich, who is Jesuit trained.
That's right.
You know, there, like I said, in some cases there's not even 6 degrees, it's more like 3 degrees of separation between these people. The Jesuits have educated our politicians. I mean, Bill Clinton was educated at Georgetown University. And the seepage into the culture and into the educational system. And look, I said this to, I don't know if you were in on this conversation or not, Gordon. What I said to Viz a few weeks ago is it's real simple, talking about the Supreme Court. What's being enshrined on the Supreme Court are two forms of law that interlock. It's mercantile law and canon law from the Vatican. The whole point of the concordant with Nazi Germany in 1929 was largely so that the Vatican could maintain canon law powers within the Nazi Empire. And the arguments made by people such as Philip Collins that they couldn't have possibly known at that point what Hitler was are absurd.
But it's ridiculous. They knew exactly who he was and what he was.
Then you have to ask yourself the question, is this the Church of Jesus Christ? Did Jesus Christ recognize who the government was? Did he tell them to
absolutely
get into bed with this beastly government that was going to kill millions of people? I think not. It's very obvious that, you know, I mean, even the founding, going back to Ignatius Loyola, what was Loyola's pattern? It was Constantine. With this sign, I will conquer.
Hey, Randy, I would love to hear Philip Collins try to explain away Pius XII's close relationship with Antipavelich then.
Yeah, Antipavelich actually stayed at Pius XII's summer home, one of his summer homes. I think it was Castle Gandolfo or something like that. I'm not very good with Italian or... But I mean, Pavlovich was protected by the Roman Catholic Church. There's just no doubt about it. And I mean, their ties to the Ustasha in Croatia and the horrible. I mean, when you read about the type. I mean, at least the SS wanted to do the Jews and their other enemies in, you know, quickly. But the Ustasha just. I mean, they would beat people in the head with sledgehammers. They would cut people's throats, you know, with saws.
They would take horrible. They would photograph themselves while doing it while they were smiling, and that's in the book. Those photos are in the book, The Vatican Holocaust by Avril Manet.
Sadistic glee while they're killing another human being. I mean, it goes beyond comprehension. Even the SS was disgusted with the Eustachy. There were reports back to Berlin saying these people are over the top. You know, they're going to make such a mess of this that, you know, it's going to get out into the public. And really, Himmler and the SS, the higher-ups in the Nazi Party, did not want it known what was going on. They wanted to exterminate their enemies as quietly as possible, because there was always the possibility they might lose the war, which obviously they did, and then reprisals could take place. And the main reason why behind the Nazi rat lines was to get those guys out of Europe so they can't tell what happened and that none of it would scrape off on the Roman Catholic Church.
We got an answer back from the interested one who asked the question about the universal church name. He says it's something like the Ancient Mysteries of the Orient. I don't know much about that.
No.
I've heard that phrase before, but...
Yeah, so have I.
Wait, now, hold on. You guys might be thinking of some of those words as somewhat reminiscent, if you will, of OTO.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's OTO.
Okay, I've got a quote here I was looking up for on the thing with Donnie Pavlich, and it's from Loftus' book, Unholy Trinity. And it says, one of the most heinous Nazis to escape with the help of the Vatican was Ante Pavlović, head of the brutal Croatian Ustasi government in World War II. Before fleeing to Argentina, where he became an aide to Juan Perón, Pavlović was actually physically sheltered in Castel Gandolfo, the Pope's summer residence. And this says, from a confidential source, American intelligence had discovered in 1946 that the Pavlovnik was living close to Rome in a building which is under the jurisdiction of the Vatican. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, this man was an out-and-out mass murderer being sheltered by the Pope and in one of his own residences. It defies description, and yet the overwhelming majority of Americans have no idea that something like that could have happened.
He was also responsible for the assassination of the King of Yugoslavia and the French ambassador prior to World War II.
Right, right. I think Edmund Paris talks about that, how that the people in France were somewhat shocked by that. Well, they were shocked by it. And just the brutality of these people, you know, just, I think, shocked all of Europe when it finally came out into the open as to what they had done.
Hey, I just thought of something, Randy. If the person in the chat room is still there, who was asking about connections between Masonry and the Jesuits, you know, another book that goes into that a lot. I did mention it, but it's that book, The Grand Design by John Daniel. He writes a lot about that in that book, how the Vatican co-opted Masonry in the 1700s.
Also, I've been looking around for that universal church, whatever that is. And, I mean, I'm just doing a search like anybody else can. I don't really know what's going on there. It makes me curious, but is there a point? I mean, is there something about it? Could that individual speak to...
can you elaborate some more before we get out of here?
Well, what it is, about the church. Because there was a falling out between the Eastern Orthodox and the Vatican, and I believe it had to do with who had custodialship over Jerusalem, which the Vatican desires badly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Apparently, some peace was made during the funeral of John Paul II. But there was a great falling out between those two for some time.
And that is yet another atrocity on their record. Which crusade was it? The fourth, where you had the Roman Catholic crusaders, instead of going to the Holy Land, they took a detour to the north and totally wiped out the Eastern Orthodox capital of Constantinople. Mm-hmm. Pillaged it.
Yeah, there's always been a great deal of enmity between the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. I mean, that was the impetus behind slaughtering the Serbs in Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
We were just talking about the Ustashi and the Croatians. So that was the basic generation of all that hatred there was between the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. And that's something that needs to be brought out, too, is people, you know, always talking about the Holocaust and World War II and all the Jews that were killed, and then I believe they were, no question about it, but also needs to be brought out that there were millions of other people, and many of them were Orthodox Christians and other Eastern European people, and of course Russian prisoners of war, etc. The Nazis killed more than just 6 million Jews. They killed probably closer to like 12, 14 million people.
You know, Harry used to say to me that when he was growing up, and Harry's in yours, Larry, and my cohort, age cohort.
Yeah.
He said he remembered the number was higher when he was growing up. I couldn't really remember anything. He said it was around 12, 13, or 15, and they brought it down.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just thinking to myself that it wasn't an over-assessment, that was the real assessment, but it made it more palatable by cutting it almost in half or even more than half.
I think that's true, and you know, the as time goes by, you have all these. I'm not saying that everybody is a Holocaust denier who doesn't, you know. I mean, I'm not equating everybody who questions the Holocaust with being a Nazi, but there's a lot of just pure crap out there about, you know, the Holocaust, and they always want to equate the Holocaust with just the Jews. Well, there was a lot more
right.
people than just the Jews. The Nazis had a lot of enemies. The Nazis were on a campaign of genocide, you know, and they had a lot of help from people like the Ustashi, and the Ustashi had their own axes to grind, literally, against their enemies, the Serbs, who, and it was basically a religious conflict. Of course, they killed Muslims, too, for that matter, and they killed Gypsies. They killed, you know, you name it, anybody they didn't like, they killed them.
You know what is really creepy? If you look at those Holocausts as a continuation of the Inquisition from the Middle Ages and make that connection...
That's exactly what I put in my article, and that's what I've always thought. And that's why I think that the whole thing with fascism was just a continuation of the Inquisition. I mean, that was one of their main... If you read Mein Kampf, you know, it's implied that they're gonna get rid of their opposition, that they're gonna clean things up, and you know, Hitler was put into power by the Roman Catholic Church, and you know, I mean, they were his main source of support. I mean, that can be proven historically. So I mean, what was the ultimate outcome there? And anyway, it's gonna look bad for anybody who is an enemy of theirs.
I'm sorry, I wasn't laughing at you. I was laughing because the chat room's now taking turns smacking down Marcus every time he plays. It's like whack-a-mole. This is Rich. You want to come on our chat room, dude? Fine, have at it. Our listeners know how to
whack-a-mole.
Smack you down. They all figured out how to use the block button. Cool.
Hey, also, you know, Revelation 17, 18, that's the big one that identifies pretty clearly Rome, but... It also seems to indicate that Rome will be wiped out in an hour, and everybody's going to be astonished by that, and sometime in the future. But, you know, that might not be as far-fetched as you think. And I recently came across a reference from, again, Abra Manhattan. He writes about this in more than one of his books, though, I think. During World War II, right before Hitler was going to invade Russia, an anti-Roman general, a very patriotic Yugoslavian, his last name was Mirkovich, he pulled off a coup, took control in Yugoslavia. His reign lasted only 5 months, and I'll tell you why in a second, but he had his air force ready to go, and Manhattan writes that he was going to bomb the Vatican, and what stopped him was the Vatican intelligence tipped off Hitler, and Hitler then had to invade Yugoslavia and took care of that and wiped out the Yugoslav Air Force on the ground. But this, Manhattan writes that pretty convincingly, that this is what caused Hitler to not be able to take Moscow because it delayed his invasion of Russia.
Yeah.
His southern flank was not covered suddenly.
Yeah, well, there's also a little quip about that, and that is the reason why the Lord did that is because he's saving him for himself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one thing we weren't able to get to that I'd like to talk about sometime is the Vatican Bank and the Vatican banking scandals and, you know, what was going on with all of that. I know that the Vatican Bank came into existence because that was the one monetary entity in the world that was completely immune from outside audits. And they're protected by a Vatican sovereignty.
Well, don't forget what the informers told us about where the money actually goes in the United States. Right,
yeah.
In, you know, he claims that they go right into the Vatican coffers.
I really haven't read much of that guy's work,
it goes through the Bank of London first,
right?
And then, yeah.
Which is an interesting triangulation. I've said for a long time, I think you can triangulate Britain, Rome, and Jerusalem on some level, and you basically have a power axis that's been formed there, although it's not so obvious with Jerusalem.
You're cueing Viz now to talk about King George and his title.
Go for it.
But let's remember something, too. But the I-Man and myself, through all the interviews we did, it was during off-mic period, late in the shows that we did, near the end. And he made this offhand comment like, you know, I was like, no big deal, or I knew it or something like that. But he told me, ultimately, that how he got expunged from the IRS system in the United States was by having to eventually file paperwork with the Vatican.
Right.
The Vatican then went ahead and prevailed upon the Attorney General of the UK to tell the IRS, let him go. Now, he is not somebody who trifles fools, and he doesn't involve, you know, he doesn't engage in hyperbole. So when he said that, and he said, you know, one day I'd go through the whole thing, he goes, but I've got to tell you, it's kind of boring when you go through the forms. But the other thing is, and like you said, Gordon, there's been an interesting relationship between the Vatican and Great Britain through the centuries. You could argue that after the Roman Empire, the next greatest one that was as far flung, I mean, about what other empire do they say the sun never sets on it? And that's Great Britain. And as a result, I believe that the Vatican basically sicked Great Britain on us to keep us in line. And after all, let's face it, most of what happened here was a commercial enterprise that was funded by Great Britain.
Well, this 1213 is the significant date, because that was when King John of England gave up his sovereignty of England.
That's right.
Gave it all over to the Pope at that time, which 2 years later you got the Magna Carta written, but that renders the Magna Carta moot.
That's right. They supposedly reinstated it, but yeah, I mean, it was clear. Also, the Iron Man will also show that all law, wherever started from Hammurabi on, reverts now to ecclesiastical law out of the Vatican. And again, they're not kidding. I say they, and I mean the popes, calling themselves vicars of Christ and saying we own it all. That's exactly what they believe. And if anybody wants that that bull from Pope Leo the 13th, and this is what Charles had dug up, all I did was I just transcribed what was in the JPEG. And typed it up. The JPEG is there also if people don't believe it. If you can read it, that's great. But I'll give it to anybody who wants to. Just give me an email at visigoth@hotmail.com, and I'll give you a transcription. But again, that was Charles who dug that up. And,
you know, one thing we also didn't talk about is two of the most powerful institutions in the world. I use the term institution loosely about one of them, but it's the CIA and the Mafia. And both of them have very strong connections to the Vatican.
Knights of Malta.
Exactly. I mean, of course, the Mafia's connections are hidden, but they're there. I mean, you know, it's not a coincidence that this is an Italian the Mafia originated in Italy. Actually, Sicily, I guess.
I was going to say, the Sicilians will have a little argument with that.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what I'm saying? It's like... I mean, the CIA, I can't think of any of the major CIA, higher ups, with the exception of George Bush Senior, that were not Roman Catholic. And some of
them were not Knights of Malta.
Yeah, right.
Well, here's a bones, man.
I mean, and then you go in, there's other connections, power connections like Opus Dei. That's a very powerful group, and they have connections with Jose Maria Escrivá was the man who founded Opus Dei, and he was a very, very good friend of Franco, and Franco thought very well of him, etc., and they kind of scratched each other's backs, figuratively. And, there's all these power connections to all these powerful groups that the Vatican has influence, and sometimes more than just influence, they have control, or at least partial control of these groups. I mean, there's so much to talk about when you get on this on the subject of the Vatican and its power relationships.
Larry, they seem to control both sides, like the get the dialectic going, because they even got like many of the teabag party types rooting for a guy like Alan Keyes when Alan Keyes is Opus Dei.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're serious. I mean, Opus Dei is not to be taken lightly. That's some serious people. If you look at their belief systems, they're not kidding around.
Mel Gibson's another one.
That was interesting to me when Mel Gibson got his butt arrested for drunk driving, and the arresting officer, I guess, had a Jewish last name, and he starts going off on the Jews. It's like, and then later, oh, I really don't dislike Jews, and it's like, yeah, sure you don't.
Well, I'm sorry, Larry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
All right. Most of the people who have a problem with the Vatican thing are pretty much, at the very mildest, I'll say detractors of Zionism, or plain just Jew bashers.
Yeah.
And so therefore, if you go after the Vatican, therefore you are, pro-Zionist or whatever, which, we are not. But the one thing I've always wondered about, and I seldom get I actually never get a good answer, is when I hear about Jews, I'm like, okay, well, can you tell me, give me the profile of what a Jew is so I know?
Yeah, that's a tough one to define, isn't it? Is it a race? Is it a religion? Is it an ethnic background? What is it?
I mean, this is the oldest bigotry I've ever heard of.
Oh, yeah.
And if you directed that kind of rhetoric toward blacks, good luck with that.
Do you remember when Mel Gibson was doing his thing where he was having the Passion of Christ, the Jewish community, certain people came out, oh man, don't do that. Don't bring this out because they were afraid of being persecuted. Well, they got a long memory, because back in the Middle Ages when they would have the Passion Place, that was the time when all the local yahoos would go out and literally do some Jew bashing, And the Roman Catholic Church would just kind of take a, turn a blind eye to it. Yeah, go ahead, kick the Jews' butts. Who cares? Let's go ahead and let's get them out of the community here if we can, And it's really, don't get me wrong, I mean, it's a wonderful thing, to portray the crucifixion and all that, the story of Jesus Christ, the gospel, but I don't think that's what that was all about.
At St. Leo's, there was an artwork of Christ on his way to the cross, complete with the thorns around the head. Now, to confirm this, I brought Harry up one day, and also the assistant director of the library, and I said, take a look at this. It's like the old Jim Croce song, you look like a jigsaw puzzle with a couple of pieces gone. Yep. He was so cut up that there was more cuts than there was skin. And I'm saying, after a certain point, it's like, what's the point, dude?
Yeah.
And this whole thing, also with Gibson's movie, I'm sorry, but to me, it's like you're doing a little bit more than depicting the crucifixion scene.
You seem to take too much pleasure in seeing Christ suffer. You know what I mean?
Well, that's kind of where I'm coming from.
It's the opposite. It's the opposite of what they say they're doing. What they really want to do is crucify him all over again, because they're really not on his side, I mean, I know that's kind of a stretch, but... That may be a stretch.
That's why on their crosses it still features him hanging there.
Exactly. I'm always, my dad once, you know, tried to explain that to me when I was a kid, and I couldn't understand it because when I went to church, you know, we had like one wooden cross, you know, on the church steeple, and that's it, you know. And it's like, why do they have Jesus hanging on the cross, Dad? And he tried to explain it to me, and, you know, that it didn't make much sense to me then, but it still doesn't. But I think it's kind of the whole idea behind the mass, you know, that they talk about how they're, you know, crucifying him all over again. Well, that's not the point, man.
Going back to what Gordon had said, Gordon, the account in Revelation about how it'll be destroyed in a blink of an eye.
Yeah.
So too will Babylon, or what we consider, I don't know, I say we, because Paul and Sandhu and I have been talking about this, and I think we're all in agreement that mercantilism is the way of the world. If we went back to the root of everything, if we had followed divine law, if we had been obedient, there would be no money. There would be no actual money. We would do business in another fashion, trading, barter, whatever.
We would have property.
But since that was rejected, Satan got in there, and I'm not, you know, of course we're not saying that, if you know, that every banker's bad or any merchant's bad. No, I mean, this is the system that runs the world. But so often we think it's about something patriotic, or, you know, a place that's going to shelter people yearning to be free. No, it isn't. It's a new market. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the only reason there was immigration in the United States is that they just hung out a sign over the Queen of Goddesses torch in New York Harbor that said, "Help Wanted." This is all about markets and money. It's always about the money. And mercantilism and the whole system will be destroyed in the latter days. But until that time comes, and that's what people have to remember about the United States too, I don't know where this association came between God having a special dispensation toward the United States. You know, that's part of the fractured fairy tale we live with. No, it isn't. It was an endeavor from the Crown, the Virginia Trading Company. And you know what's interesting, too? And people will say, well, that's because we won the Revolutionary War. But think about this.
Well,
we paid the French for the Louisiana Purchase. We paid, I think, the Spanish for the Gadsden Purchase. You know, we stole a whole lot of stuff. But we never paid the Crown for the 13 estates. And then people go, well, that's because we won the war. Read the treaty that ended the war. All King George, and if Britain was a loser, then why did King George draft the terms? That's all I want
to
know.
Why didn't we have to pay him?
Does the victor dictate the terms?
That's right.
And we had to make payments to him.
Yeah.
I mean,
the loser's dictating the terms. I don't think so. That doesn't make sense, you know?
All that treaty says is just states, not colonies anymore. Let's go on with business.
Yeah.
Soldiers didn't have to leave in a hurry. They all got their arms back. Territorial waters were all bordered the same way. We didn't win anything. All they figured they would do is go ahead and get us financial.
They cut on the action a little bit. They cut the aristocracy in on the action a little more. Maybe
they turned us into a corporation. One single corporation, yeah.
And I mean, despite the, you know, whatever, you know, Beavis and Butthead said about a corporation, the United States is a corporation. That's all there is to it. You know, what else do you want to know? Well, I mean, when we got into that thing, I never extrapolated to where they went. They create what we said, and then they go ahead and they denigrate it. It's like, I didn't, you know, I'm not saying you put your labor on the stock market. What are you talking about? We're a corporation, and it says so, and that's all there is to it. You know, we don't have to go into the whole thing about how you have two personages as it relates to this country. It's business. That's what it all is. It's business. And even in this book, Code Word Babylon, a book that doesn't get published in the United States for some strange reason,
I wonder why.
Yeah.
Well, it talks even here about how, I know what it is, in Constantine Day, I'm sorry, it's the history of Rome. Real quick, why don't I just get through it to a second? I'm just brushing up on it before I talk to you guys, but it said, here we go. All right, that's not it. And I'm not gonna waste any time. I'll take a look as we go on. But it said what Constantine did was he, you know, the churches became corporations.
Well, Constantine was a political genius. He never became a Christian. He was a pagan to the day he died.
Okay,
he saw the opportunity to take the Christian belief system and use it for his own purposes. You know, it's perfect. You know,
I got it. If I can read it to you guys, this is about Constantine. He said, grant to all the subjects of the empire, east and west alike, and the Christian churches were recognized as legal corporations. Thus, Constantine's attitude to the church is unambiguous, but the true nature of his, quote, conversion, end quote, remains as enigmatic as his character. He has been depicted at one extreme as religiously committed to Christ, at the other as merely using Christianity as an instrument and a policy of self-aggrandizement. The truth probably lies somewhere between. That was a state-run, you know, you have a state-run religion, and that is not only an oxymoron, but it's a paradox. The state, as Christ knew it, could not have anything to do with the church and vice versa.
I'll tell you the value of his conversion. After his supposed conversion, he murdered his family.
Doesn't everybody?
Wow.
Okay.
Well,
that's scary. Yeah, that's some conversion there.
I think Dave Hunt covers that. Yeah.
I don't see any more questions in the chat room,
okay.
So I think we'll go around the table, wrap it up, because I've had enough of my buttons pushed tonight, and I'm not going to explode on the air. And Larry, I'll start with you first because you kind of got interrupted a couple of times, and I apologize for that.
No problem. Wrap it up. Okay. I think basically, you know, we're all in agreement that the Roman Catholic Church is that entity in Revelation, the woman that rides the beast. And I think we have quite a bit of evidence there that this is the Roman Catholic Church is an extremely powerful and sinister institution, at least from the standpoint of the Vatican. And if we talk about the development of that particular religion, and I think we could sum it up saying this, that a woman rides the beast, and that's all I have to say, Randy.
Amen. Gordon, final thoughts.
Keep it short and succinct. Here's a real concise way to defeat those who would label us Zionists or who blame the Zionists for everything. You want to believe that the Zionists are behind everything and they're at the top. Okay. Go do the research about who killed Abraham Lincoln. Those who really killed Abraham Lincoln, the Vatican, they did so when Zionism was a political zygote.
Yep. And finally, Mr. Visigoth.
If people want to do the research, they'll find it out.
Yep.
And to a certain extent, does it really matter? Most of us won't be around for this, by the way. Does it matter? You could say it doesn't. For me, it did. And now that I found it out, I mean, there really isn't much to do afterward. All this other stuff that we see on this Patriot Broadcasting is either deliberate distraction or ignorance or arrogance, one of the three. It's not going to be Russia. It's not going to be Israel. It's the mastermind of this whole situation is Satan, and where he presides and resides is behind the facade that is the Vatican. The other thing I think people have to realize is that the United States is in the crosshairs of probably most of the world. But I think it's pretty accurate that the next war is meant to dash us, as other ones were to dash Germany or Napoleon's France. It is our time now. You know, we've been hitmen for over a century, and we're going to get paid back in spades. And much like in the Civil War, we think of the monarchies, we think of the Vatican as being effete, just a bunch of foolish people. Well, that's the way they wanted it. But they're coming back. And as you guys just mentioned, too, I think you did, Larry, we're going to see the last manifestation of the Roman Empire that's going to be the European Union. And I would contend, through some works done by Rosicrucians and others, written back as far as the beginning of the 20th century, before World War I, that there will be a World War III. And probably Europe isn't going to get anything on them at all. This one's for us. So I ask people to look into it. Another book you can read with that kind of projection is Lord of the World by Robert E. Benson.
Yeah, that's great.
And any Mackinder's work that talks about where the last empire will be decided in what patch of land, which he calls the heartland, Brzezinski calls the chessboard. So it's an interesting time, but it's going to be very perilous. And again, I don't think I'll be around for this one, or that old guy, Larry. But it doesn't make a difference. I mean, we want to let people know. We have no idea when it's going to happen. So, at any rate, the information's there. If you want to ignore it, that's up to you. But just don't tell me it's bogus.
Yeah, we're going to put these. We'll compile all these references that we have, plus what we had already put up. They'll go up with links with the podcast of the show. And I would expect to see the shows up probably Sunday sometime. There's a little post-production that has to be done. And, gosh, what else? A thank you to the chat room. You guys were great tonight. It was fun.
Let it go.
In a kind of sick way. No, we've got some great people in there. There were good questions, good discussions. Thanks to Charles Wilcox, who popped in as well and entertained some issues. We'll put lots of links up with these shows. We're going to give a permanent record for this. Scripture tells
Bill
us.
Bill Hughes.
And yeah, absolutely.
Yep, Bill Hughes.
Absolutely. Thanks to both of those people who contributed to the show. And like I said, we're going to put it on the record. We'll put it up with the podcast. They'll be there, and you can use that as a resource reference for yourself and to point other people to. That's what it's really all about, is sharing our faith. And this is part of that faith walk, too, finding the truth about the deceptions. So I'm Randy Moggins, and my thanks to my co-host tonight, Keith Hansen, Gordon Comstock, and Larry from Austin. You guys were awesome. I learned a lot. I'm looking forward to going back and really digging into this stuff. So we're going to back it out of here, and you guys stay on the line, and the rest of you, have a great weekend. Enjoy what I hope will be a great Memorial Day, regardless of, whatever it is you're remembering. With that, we're out of here. Good night. God bless.